welcome you to our third pharmaceutical waste product stewardship summit. We've got folks from around the country here today, and we really have a jam-packed program. Talk a little bit more about logistics very shortly, but to give you a key welcome to the city, we're lucky to have Mayor Tom Barrett with us today, and come on up.
Thank you, Stevie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sunny shining. That's a good thing. And I just wanted to stop by to thank you for being here in Milwaukee. In addition to being the mayor of the city, I'm also this year the chair of the Great Lakes and St. Louis River City Initiative. That's an initiative by national. In fact, probably two-thirds of the mayors are from the city inside of the Great Lakes. And we meet here several times to deal with issues ranging from water quality to sustainability, environmental sustainability, economic vitality. So issues like Asian carp, the diversion from the Great Lakes, are issues that are at the top of our agenda. But pharmaceuticals is an issue that has come up and will continue across the border for you to deal with issues of pharmaceuticals. In the Great Lakes alone, fishing is a multi-billion-dollar industry, so it's imperative that we're doing everything we can to make sure that the waters remain as true as they can be. And as we learn more about pharmaceuticals going into the Great Lakes, that becomes more and more of a concern. So when I heard from Steve that you were going to be having this conference, I thought, well, this is in our sweet spot, because we understand that this is an issue that has to be dealt with. For the Great Lakes, but it's not just the Great Lakes, obviously, landfills, and just the proper disposition of pharmaceuticals is an important issue. And I certainly agree that the concept of extended food service responsibility is an important one. And anything that we can do to promote that, I think we can all benefit. Here in southeastern Wisconsin, 2006, our MMSD, which is our sewage district, had a program over at the Walmart. Where we gathered in over 21,000 of pharmaceuticals. But we also know, as happy as we are about that, that not that 98% of pharmaceuticals are not returned as they should be. So this is a real world issue that we're facing. And I love the collaboration. I love the private sector initiative to do this because our sewage district deals with this issue a lot. So again, I wanted to thank you. As mayor of the city of Milwaukee, I also have some that role, and that is, I know many of you are not from the city, but as you travel throughout the country, you can just sort of each city has their own little customs as well. And our custom is a little different. We have bars here, I don't know if that. But our custom is that before you leave the city, we simply ask that you take a minute, just take 1 minute, and make sure that you've spent all your money.
Hello, we're on the phone. We can't hear anything at all other than clapping. Yes, that's a bit better.
Comments, but it's this summit on public safety every
summit, and this year the goal is protecting our children. So we have a three-day program on internet crime against children, or elementary school shootings, so he has to be up there marshaling that group. The reason why they have to do it is because I supervise the state's major drug programs. I think I have a methamphetamine program, I have a marijuana program, and unfortunately, like many states across our nation right now, we're seeing a significant increase in heroin and other opiate use. So I'm doing a lot of stuff on the heroin side of the house. Since 2010, since DEA started their National Take Back Initiative, we've been we partnered very closely with DEA to support the National Take Back, and we're basically attached at the hip with DEA. J.D. Van Hollen is a very avid sportsman, and he's very devoted to protecting our national resources, which in Wisconsin we have 5.4 million acres of public hunting land and 7.4 acres of waterways, including two Great Lakes. And he is a very strong supporter of the National Take Back Initiative, so that's why he directed us to partner with DEA. So since 2010, Wisconsin's had a very, very successful program, and I'm on the panel later on this afternoon, and I'll show you some of our successes, but we've been ranked within the top five states in the nation every year since 2010 in our support of the program, and it's just a great collaboration of state agencies, whether it's State Patrol, DNR, State Department of Justice, the Wisconsin guy, and the National Guard. So it's a great use of state resources. And more importantly, from a selfish point of view, I would say that I see over the years with my programmatic oversight of the heroin group, the relationship between prescription opiates and then the diversion of those opiates to that of heroin. And unfortunately, we have to get that stuff out of the medicine cabinet. We have to get it off the kitchen counters. And that's why we're such strong supporters of these take-back initiatives. And whatever we can do to get that away, because that'll reduce the amount of people that are possibly become addicted, and then unfortunately they're going to heroin. So we're going to continue keeping up the good fight, and I'm going to come back later on this morning because I'm very interested in hearing some of the other presentations, and then I'll be on the panel this afternoon. So again, on behalf of J.B. Van Hollen, welcome to Wisconsin. You're going to have a beautiful night for that river cruise, I believe. It's going to be beautiful, and so enjoy. Thank you.
As I mentioned before, this is our third meeting. Many of you have been in this room before and been really working hard on this project. We'll get a lot more about that. Jennifer Binford and I are going to cover that discussion, just where we've gone and where we're hoping to go. But before we do any of that in terms of the program, let's do some quick logistics because that's only fair. Each of you received a jump drive this morning. There's not a huge amount of stuff on it, but the key elements of it, I'll just mention quickly. We have a couple of attendees with us, one that's electronic that you can use for emailing. We have an overview of the regional roundtables that have been going on. All the slides from the summit presentation, so you don't have to take copious notes. You've got them electronically. And, of course, the agenda. So that's yours to take her home and hopefully something for the process. Bathrooms are located down the hall, men's and women's. So if you really feel free to use them. And we're going to do lunch around the corner. We have a lunchroom there, and we're scheduled to mosey over there about 12:30 or so, about an hour for lunch. Quickly, the boat leaves at 5 o'clock this evening, so we're planning breaking here at 4:30. I'll be a contingent over to the Voyager boat that goes out into the harbor. We'll spend some time talking a little bit about walking waterways and just enjoying ourselves. And lastly, we've got a blue handout that I whipped up last night. No, I almost forgot. This is restaurant week walking, so that's kind of perfect. $20 to $30, depending on which restaurant you go. The ones with asterisks, like website, you can see that. So feel free to enjoy that, and if you would like that. So, without further ado, we have a key partner in this project that we've been involved with the USCPA for quite a while. And I'd like to introduce Scott Cassell from the Groundwater Stewardship Institute, executive director, and he's on this line. Scott.
Thank you. Nice to see some friendly and new faces here, some folks that I know quite well. Let me ask those that are on the phone, are you hearing any better?
Yes, you're pretty good.
Anyone on the phone? Are you still there?
Yeah, you just got better. You're just coming through better now.
Okay, I can hear you now. Okay, can you keep talking? Say something else?
Testing.
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 That's good. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's kind of distant.
Yeah, distant, but better than it was 3 minutes ago.
All right. So, is this any better?
That is much better.
Much better.
All right, so I know that we wanted to move this as far as we could, of course, for some restrictions here. So I don't want to unplug it.
As long as everybody else on the phone puts it back on mute, because all I can hear is paper shuffling from other people on the phone after.
Moving the phone at the conference.
We'll plug in.
Is that it right there? Okay. This will go. So we can, I can come here so that you can hear me. I don't know, you can probably hear me without the mic, but this is here. And I'm standing here, so we've got both at the same time. Can you hear me okay at this point? Those on the phone, how's that?
It's pretty good. It's not as good as it was a minute ago.
Better?
Yeah, yes.
Let's stand in front of the screen. That's the best thing. Okay. All right. We will do the best we can.
I don't think that helps a lot.
That'll help us, but it won't help them. Can you put that in? It's really important to have one leader. That's all it takes, and there's a lot of leaders in this group. So I'm very optimistic for today. I'm very optimistic on this issue. And I just wanted to start with that optimism. I was going to play you a little bit of blues on the harmonica, but I figured I'd start with some. Who are we? The Product Stewardship Institute is a national nonprofit organization. We have membership from 47 states, including Wisconsin, several hundred local governments, but we also have partnership with about 100 companies, organizations, universities, and non-U.S. governments. Our board of directors, 7 states, 4 local officials. We have Dave Galvin, our president, right here from King County, Washington. And Teresa Steiner, which is right there from Iowa, another board member. Other board members that are here. Okay. Probably have some on the phone that are joining us. We also are members of the Global Product Stewardship Council, which is based in Sydney, Australia. So we work internationally on these issues as well as here in the United States. So 47 states, under the local government, lots of different stakeholders working together. These are some of the partners that we have. You can see we have brand name companies, but as well as what I like to call brand name environmental groups as well, because you need to have all the players at the table. A number of our partners are here. So what we're going to do today, we're going to have an update on the Great Lakes region. I'm going to turn it over here in a minute to Steve and Mark to go through the Great Lakes work that we've been doing together. We're then going to have a regional roundtable. We're going to have a lot of different speakers, 7 different speakers, talking about from each of the states what's going on here in the Great Lakes. Then we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about producer responsibility approaches. This is a unique issue, pharmaceutical. There's activity at the local, the state, the federal level. Supervisor Miley's going to be here. His plane is delayed, I know. Hopefully he'll be here at some point in the session. But leadership role for Alameda County, first of the nation, EPR legislation, that's unique for this issue. So local, federal, and state level issues. Taking lunch, and then we're going to come back and talk about stakeholder roles. Each product we work on is different. They all have different stakeholders. And here we have some very good spokespeople for each of the viewpoints. You need to have all those viewpoints together at the table in order to develop strong legislation and programs. And we're going to talk about the EPA regulations as well, which I'm sure many of you would like to hear about. Then we're going to have a call to action for an hour at the end of the day. We want to say not only what we've done, but what we want to do moving forward on this issue. So this is a kind of an unusual get-together for PSI. We do either dialogue meetings where people are around the table in kind of a U-shape where there's active participation, or we do conferences where it's conference-like. So this is a little bit of a mix. So we're going to have maybe, you think about it, like 50% conferences, education, but 50% participation. We want it very active. So we can't just sit there. You got it? And I know a lot of you aren't going to do that, but we want you to participate actively in the session. And that's why we set this up. I want to thank Stephanie for all her work here. Stephanie went out from BSI here helping to put all this together, working with Stephen and his crew. And I know they spent a lot of time figuring out this room, and we looked at it last night. The whole thing is conducive for participation, and then you have to kind of turn around a little bit, and you kind of flex your, whatever, maybe a little activity, but hopefully, we'll be able to participate as a group. And then, as Steve mentioned, there's a river cruise reception, so if you don't like anything else, hopefully you'll enjoy it. All right, I'm going to hand it over to you.
So, welcome. Got the backwards. As Scott mentioned, we're going to give you a quick overview. Joining me is my colleague and co-conspirator, Bart Bickford, from Wisconsin DNR.
Just checking with the folks. I was standing on the other side so they can hear your voice even without the mic. If you
don't
see if that's better.
Folks on the phone, can you hear okay?
Yeah, you're good.
Good. All right. You should see.
Quick update on our pharmaceutical project, as Scott mentioned. And Scott mentioned, this is our third year of our project and last year. So part of what we're going to see from you guys by the end of the day is how we keep our momentum going forward. We have had great partnerships, and PSI is one of our partners, the Wisconsin DNR. In addition, the Illinois Indiana Sea Grant and the Associated Recyclers of Wisconsin have been very active in this project over the last 3 years. Of course, it wouldn't happen without the support of Region 5, US EPA, and the Great Lakes Restoration Fund. So, let me turn it over to Mark.
You were doing it again. Oh, okay, no problem. Well, as Dave mentioned, we do have a public safety issue with pharmaceuticals, and there's no need to go over it a lot. But there are more people driving from drugs now than from vehicle accidents, and that happened a couple of years ago, the crossover. And we have some solutions, too. The Good Drugs Gone Bad program, developed in Wisconsin, is one that law enforcement communities are facing. Drugs Gone Bad. Okay. All right. And there are also environmental concerns. As we know, we've all heard about the form three-legged frogs and fish that are the male fish that have eggs in them. And so those effects are being documented, and there are uncertain effects on humans because, as we know, drugs are made to affect human life in very small doses. So what a small dose do in the water supply that might affect humans, we don't really know. But there are measurable amounts in our surface waters, including Lake Michigan, which supplies water to tens of millions of people down in the Great Lakes watershed. This is a diagram out of a National Geographic magazine that shows the relative amounts of these certain medications in water. And the effects of the Great Lakes, pharmaceuticals are seen as an emerging contaminant, and so the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, one of the goals of that was to deal with the emerging contaminant, so that's why we applied to the grant to cut it.
So, as I mentioned before, the project has included a strong network of partners. But we really focused on a variety of activities. One has been our mailback program. As many of you know, UW Extension started a pilot mailback program in 2008 that was located in Winnebago and Waukesha counties. With this grant, we were able to expand it to the 32 counties that are part of the Great Lakes watershed in Wisconsin. And we had terrific results for the very short period of the grant. Until the DEA announced that new regs were going to come out, and they didn't really want the mailbacks intruding in that whole process. But over 5,000 pounds of materials were collected through the mailback program. We've helped create working groups that have worked on a variety of issues, everything from problems in terms of destruction of drugs to effective collection programs and education. Regional dialogues, well, we're part of that right now. PSI has been very involved in developing model public policies, and we've gotten a couple of fact sheets that we've developed from Wisconsin. Hopefully, we've increased public awareness on that, and as I mentioned before, we've done a lot of collaboration with a wide variety of groups. Mailback program, even though it only ran 4 months, we felt was a good model, a good example, how a mailback could be an additional resource that helps facilitate proper disposal of medications. And of course, we had a number of great results from various counties across the state. What's very interesting up there, one of the darker ones, which are
counties that were the most responsive in terms of number of participating pharmacies and other drop sites, Biola's County. So there's a lot of senior citizens out there for a very small county. They were very actively involved. And, of course, we created the Pharmaceutical Waste Working Group. Bob's the co-chair with me on that, and a number of you were involved in there. Gosh, if I have a show of hands for the Pharmaceutical Waste Working Group. Done a lot of great work for over 3 years on, six years, addressing this issue.
Well, I think we did was to partner with the State Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. They were preparing a report on prescription drug abuse and solutions that could, or recommendations for Wisconsin that had to do with not just this disposal, but prescribing practices, law changes, all kinds of things. So the recommendations that had to do with disposal or prescription drug disposal were has to do with education, collection, and or donation, destruction, waste reduction, funding, and removal after death. And so we structured our working group subcommittee after these recommendations that they're reporting on. A bylaw, here's a picture from, I think, 2 years ago. Here's one of the policies that PSI shepherded through, element of pharmaceutical collection and disposal programs, and that you can see on the product stewardship website. And also, you have developed a model legislation that was used to help Pennsylvania. Okay. And then other states can use that to develop legislation if they want. Public awareness has changed quite a bit in the last few years. We found from surveys in Wisconsin that now, what used to be half the people would put their medications in the trash or down the drain, and more down the drain if you count those two together, it was like 80% of people would do that. Now, much less than half that, and more people are using questions. And we've done some collaboration. One of our more fruitful ones was collaborated with the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. One of our subgroups has developed recommendations for not only disposal but also reducing waste. And so we developed a flyer with the Pharmacy Society, and they distributed it to all their member pharmacies, which is most of them. So it talks about reduction and diversion disposal. And the last thing we've done is we've developed a website called Healthcare Facilities. Their waste as well. We recognize that it's not just a household issue. There are a lot of waste generated in healthcare facilities. So we have Dana Booth, who's here today, is working on this project with me and St. Mary's Hospital in Madison to put drugs on this website that people can go and search for a drug and find out different strategies for reducing the amount of waste involved with it.
So, what have we learned from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative? Well, there's a couple of key findings. One of the obvious ones, and many of you in the room are familiar with this, is that the lack of the Drug Enforcement Administration's regulations being issued are still really impeding things. We can't get a comprehensive program put in place until the ground rules are laid down. And people have been anticipating these regs for quite a while, and hopefully they're forthcoming. Destruction remains a challenge in Wisconsin and throughout the Great Lakes. People want to destroy beds effectively. We don't have a lot of hazardous waste facilities to process these materials, so we're looking at alternatives, ideally within state, where we can get high-temperature destruction of pharmaceuticals. Clearly, the public safety issue
very important. We have an epidemic of drug abuse with prescription medicines, and it's going to be more prominent for the near future anyway than the environmental effects, because those are so difficult to ascertain in the long term. Broad public support exists and is growing, so our goal of doing the right thing to encourage industry to get involved in the long-term solution for this problem is important, but we also recognize that legislation is not going to be easy. We've gone as far as begun drafting some legislation for Wisconsin. It hasn't hit the Senate or the Assembly yet, but hoping it will in the fall. And that'll be a test of just how difficult it's going to be. I remain optimistic because I think as people become more aware, others are going to look at it and say, hey, we need a longer-term solution. Some future directions we've got planned. We're going to try to expand instruction options. Continue to let people know what the problem is and how to deal with it. Again, working towards a centralized data solution, and you're going to hear more of that from Scott from PSI. Efforts to reduce waste, as Barb mentioned, our waste reduction website is up and running. Whatever we can do to expand coalitions, and then, of course, create new funding options for long-term support, so all the financing for solving this problem doesn't fall on local governments. As Barb mentioned, and Scott has alluded to as well, we're contracted by the DNR to look at cost issues, and what we're experiencing in Wisconsin is not the cheapest solution. So we have our neighbors to the west, British Columbia, that run a much more cost-effective industry-led program. And, of course, France is a long-term program that is very convenient and very cost-effective. Lots of resources out there to help with this effort. We maintain a blog, the waste reduction website, located on our Solid Hazardous Waste Education Center web, of course, the Product Stewardship Institute and the DNR all have good resources. John?
Can you say what the France program is that makes it so cheap? Do you know it?
Drop at pharmacies, universally, and just the number of participants. So when you get a per capita ratio with so many people, participating, the cost goes way down. So as we know in the trash business, volume really matters. And we're here as resources, both Barb and I, so don't hesitate to contact us or let us know. If you have any questions, suggestions, ideas, we'd love to hear from you.
The FDA, the EPA, and 43 states
we've been working on this issue since about 2008, and we had a number of stakeholder meetings at that time. One was in Washington, D.C., and I just wrote down the names of some of the pharmaceutical companies that came, because it was, you know, the time where they were checking things out. We had GlaxoSmithKline, King Pharmaceuticals, which now has been acquired by Pfizer, AstraZeneca, the Generic Pharmaceutical Association, Purdue Pharma, Hoffman LaRoche, Sherry Plow. They all came to these meetings and were engaged at that point on the issue. And we had our first meeting in Sacramento back in 2008. So we had a number of agreements. There were things that all the different stakeholders agreed to, the source reduction, how do you stop the problem before it becomes a problem in waste, no flushing, and then the need for the change in the law, the Controlled Substances Act, and with that, change in the DEA regulations. Because at that time, we weren't sure if there could be the DEA regulation change, and that would be the fix, but after a while, they came out and said, we can't do it. Our regulations weren't set up for take-backs. They were set up to avoid drug use and diversion. So then our focus as a group, as a community, and there's lots of people in this room and hundreds of others that work together to change the Controlled Substances Act and then to change the DEA regulation. And right now, those are still in draft stages, you probably know. We're waiting for those to come out. We'll talk about those in a little bit. So some of the issues that we went over, and these are things just to show a little history here. You know, it's not that it just cropped up over the past year or so, but there's been a lot of discussion around it. And I think that with this, the pharmaceutical industry has dug in, and Supervisor Myers will probably talk about this more when he speaks about what Alameda County has had to go through, because they're now involved in a lawsuit from the industry. But we went through a whole bunch of issues identifying collection options and different regulations that are involved. It's a very complex issue, as we're going to hear and as we know. So as Steve was mentioning, there's a lot of work that we've done together. There's a lot of resources here. There's links. We didn't want to bury you in paper. One of the links here is the bottom one, the Drug Take-Back Network. It's a website that we run. As it turned out, a King Pharmaceutical paid for that. Because they make opioids, and they wanted to make sure that if they were promoting their drugs and the doctors were promoting opioid use for medical reasons, that there was a place to take them back. Unfortunately now Pfizer has acquired King, and that waste is gone. But we still have the network, still have the take back, and a lot of good collection sites from Wisconsin and other places in the Great Lakes are on that list. What we're trying to do together, of course, we're trying to build support for producer responsibility, because if you have the problem, if you have the solution, then there needs to be who's going to pay for it. And, you know, we'll talk more about that coming up. Also, there's voluntary initiatives. They're working quite well, and there's a lot of great examples of those. So we want to promote those. We don't want to just say, you know, it's always got to be regulation. It's always got to be, you know, this, that, or the other. We have to be open for the kinds of innovation and unique solutions that can develop around people talking and getting involved with each other. And then the messaging, it's confusing. I think it's getting a little bit clearer, but we have some federal agencies. The Fish and Wildlife Service did work with pharmaceutical industry and others to promote more of the disposal end of things. And that was a problem, I think, for a number of years. So when you get down to the state and local level, you want tell your consumer the same thing that others are. If they're getting different messages, it's confusing. If people are confused, they're not going to act. So they need to know the problem and then what to do about that problem, about take that, where to take it. We need really good information and coordinated, and we're not there yet as a community. So we know that, but it's something that we're working on here with the Great Lakes region. So I think those are some of the highlights that I wanted to address. We did work on a report, thanks to Steve and to Barb. We've got some copies here. It was an analytical report. Basically, there's a lot of great programs going on in Wisconsin for KPAC. Even with all those wonderful programs, we're only collecting, or they're only collecting in Wisconsin, 2% of the household medications that really need to be collected. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and we went through some of the barriers, and of course, cost is one of those issues that we outlined. So, with that, I'm going to stop and just open it up to see if you have some questions comments that you want to make about the Great Lakes? Because we have lots of good stuff coming forward, but I just want to give the opportunity.
And if you could state your name and your affiliation as well.
The comments from those that are on the floor or no?
No.
No.
So the comment was, and I'm sorry, we're going to have to work on this in the break here, but the comment in short was that we need better IT equipment now. that hard facts are really important for convincing and to move the issue forward. You want to give other comments?
We had these working before. We had it last night. We did prep this morning. They were all working. There's so much energy in the room. You just short-circuited this whole thing. See what happened?
It's probably easier to come up near the phone. I'm Russ Jensen. I just retired as a pharmacist with the Dean St. Mary's system in Madison. I've been involved in the MedDrop program in Dane County for a number of years. But it is the... I think one of the other real advantages is with the opioid overdoses is what got law enforcement involved in the process and began the DEA take back programs and other programs that have really gotten the support of law enforcement. So that has helped, although we actually began for clean water as well. But it really moved along rapidly once law enforcement got involved in the process.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? And it might be helpful to come up here if you could really like jot up. Go ahead,
Diane.
You got
it
in
2 a.m.
You can run
out of the case. Woohoo! I'm well rested. So, I'm Megan Sanborn with the California Private Surgery Council, and we have been dealing with this issue in Alameda County. But the lawyers actually looked at the data on the water and decided to remove a lot of the intent language about water issues. So, I have to tell you something. Because the connection wasn't
clear.
Strong enough, and they were very concerned that that would create a hook for legal action. And then my question was, I think in the slide, in your report, it actually said that there were 2% participation of people in the drug program, but it said there were extensive paybacks, and I thought, well, that doesn't really make the case for paybacks, does it? I mean, I can just see pharma. I can, you know, I'm always playing in my head what they're going to say.
Well, I think in some ways that is their argument. Like, well, you know, 2%, if what they said is if we
old inflection, very few would take advantage of it. But the way we look at it is that there's 2%, and it is because of barriers. And some of those barriers, most of the barriers, are financial. So there would be more collections if there was if there was more opportunity to do so.
So the convenience isn't high enough to get a higher push because of the funding.
Yeah, there are some good sites, but there's not coverage, there's not convenience. And once there's more convenience, like any other product, as you know, you have some funding, you're able to collect them. People don't want to collect because if you collect them, then you're going to have to pay for the disposal. I mean, that's the issue with most of the pharmacies, is that they would like to collect, just like, you know, in Haines or other places, as you know, is that they want to do their part, they want to play their role, but they don't want to step up, collect, pay for the equipment, and also pay for the disposal. Once that is handled, then there's more of a coverage.
I would just say that I think we should be really, really careful about what we put out in the public arena right now, especially the pushback that we're seeing, and that if we think convenience was the issue, then maybe we should say, due to lack of convenience, we did not have higher participation rates. We definitely, the convenience level is not there because we don't have enough funding. Because
yeah.
That really is what it all comes down to, is we don't have enough money to do these programs the way we'd like to.
Certainly not to the comprehensive impact that we would like to harder to find.
Yes.
Hold up, Mark.
Because if it was a larger number, 50% of all the waste
thanks for that comment, because that's, as Dave Gellin and I know, and others who've been working on the household hazardous waste issue for a really long time, that's the barrier. And we were saying for a long time that if you collected all the waste that's out there and really made the environmental difference that we all want to make, municipalities would be bankrupt across the United States. So thank you. You know, that's the balance that we have here. We're kind of pushing the envelope. The infrastructure matches what we're collecting. We're showing how to do it, and we're showing how these programs can get a little bit more efficient with it. But we know that there will be more collected if the funding is there to do so. And I could just, if I could just 1 second on one of these. Oregon is a great example for a paint program. And they had zero retailers collecting in Oregon before the EPR law went into place a couple of years ago. Now 80% of the collections are at retail because they want to get people into the store. And they don't have to pay for that collection. They get people in to buy something else, and the cost of the leftover paint management is covered. So you'll see the pharmacies here will love this program because it's going to get people back into the pharmacies, because that's great advertising. We did a whole project with Staples showing computer take back, the same thing. The employees loved this, everyone loved it, and they had to charge a fee. Well, when the EPR laws were in place, they didn't need to charge a fee, and they collect one. So you'll see it over and over again, and we're just hitting up on those limits. Yes. Name and affiliation, please.
Dan Schultz with Jeffrey Community, Washington County. The question, you know, money takes a toll, and is there a connection or a distant diagram how much money is spent on court fees and associations and the counties that are paying for drug addicted children and adults versus the cost of what it would cost to take back in some cases?
Great question. Does anyone know the answer? I was just at a drug abuse conference in Orlando. It was the second one annually. And they had 1,000 people there. Mayor Bloomberg spoke. I mean, it's such a huge issue. As we know societally, as John said, the second cause of death here among people. So, Mark, you have some data?
We've had broad support on this issue from a lot of attorneys general and from prosecutors. I can tell you from King County is we went to our prosecuting attorney's office and we said, we'd like to know your data on drug crime arrests. They don't code for that in their system. And I think we're back to a financing issue. They don't have the database to tell us exactly what they're spending on drug use. If any of your counties do, please help us find that information. But in King County, we don't.
I happen to have a paper in front of me on the economic cost of non-opioid, so it doesn't directly answer the question, but in 2006, we're saying that the estimated total cost in the U.S. is 54 billion. Yes, it doesn't answer your question. I just happen to have the data in front of me, and I have a question. Okay. Who should I talk to about how pharmaceutical waste was measured?
For those that are on the phone, the questions were around the cost of preventing drug abuse. So Stephanie's asking a repeat question. So I'm just going to do a little bit here, little anecdotes to keep people on the phone and how difficult it is. And thank you for those that are on the phone for sticking with us here. I appreciate it. And let me turn to any of you, because we've got you mic'd up. If you'd like to ask some questions, we can pipe it into the room. Do you have some questions or comments, those that are on the phone?
It's always a good test. Not multi-test.
Hey, Scott, I do have a question.
Okay. Name and affiliation, please.
Yeah, it's Dan King with the Nebraska Meds Coalition.
Hi, Dan.
Hello. Just wondering if folks that are in the audience or any of the presenters know of states that are using supplemental environmental protection dollars for the funding piece of the issue?
You're wondering if any of them were using the SEPs here?
I'm sorry?
Your question was whether or not any of the agencies here are using supplemental environmental project funds to fund their collection programs for pharmaceuticals?
That's correct.
People are familiar with those. It's sort of an alternative. The funding can go to a public purpose instead of going into the general fund when there's enforcement actions from the federal, state, or local level. Anyone using these SEP funds? It's kind of a unique thing. Are you using them in Nebraska?
Yeah. We're not now currently, but just recently Nebraska, was basically the recipient of what amounted to almost $1 million in a large settlement, and so I think that's that money's been transferred in some way or another to our Attorney General's office, and so they have played a role in kind of setting up the DEA take back days or supporting that or not from time to time. And so I'm just interested on, not only do we have an unfunded mandate for prescription drug monitoring, but we also, could put those funds to good use as well to really substantiate and create a better uniform system here. So just wondering if other states had seen a use for those funds or if they had applied those funds to their programs.
I'll tell you, we're going on our third-plus year of a fairly large one for a state that could be used for this purpose ourselves, and it's a long, long process. We did get some small funding from the same state to do some other kind of EPR work, but it is a good lever, and if you don't know more about that, I think there's opportunities there, but it is a way to look at it. Just take one more comment or question. Let's go here onto the phone again. Thanks, Dan. See if there's anyone else that has a comment or a question. Those on the phone? Okay, anyone here? Last question? Yeah. Leslie, the mic is coming.
As I listened to Leslie Wilson, president of the Minnesota Product Leadership Council and Carver County, Minnesota. As I listened to us all discuss about this, I think about the weird paradigm that local government's responsibility is to protect the environment for public health. And on the one hand, we want to collect the waste so that the public health is not impacted. And on the other hand, when we collect the waste, we perpetuate the problem. Because things keep being done the way they're done. Made the way they're made, and disposed the way they're disposed. And so I think that's the truth about what we're all struggling through. And I think that from a local government perspective, that's really what we're trying to find a solution to. And it's very tricky. But I think our elected officials really need to understand that that's the complex problem that we're dealing with.
Okay, we're going to switch gears quickly at this point. And thanks very much for just jumping right in. That was great. We're going to move to our next part of the agenda at 10 o'clock. It's 10 o'clock. And those that are on the phone, we're going to do the regional roundtable. The way we're going to do this is that we're going to have, because of the setup, we can't have everyone right up here, or else you wouldn't see the slides. So we're going to have each person come up for 5 minutes. We're going to do a kind of lightning round, if you will. Come up, speak for 5 minutes, come down. So each of these folks at the front are going, really, is that what we're doing? So we're going to just do up, down, and then at the end, everyone will be up here. We'll do a little Q&A. All right? So our first speaker is Walter Willis. And Walter is with SWALCO, Solid Waste Association of Lake County, Illinois.
Good morning. Thank you, Scott. Oh, I don't know what these slides are.
Oh.
I can't see it on this. Sorry about that. Yeah, I just wanted to give a little bit more of an intro. from New York, and Chad and Scott are going to be coming in through the phone. And what we've asked them all to do is answer these three questions generally. And what we're trying to do with this session is to give a sense about how waste pharmaceuticals are being handled in each of the states, to get a regional perspective. So this is kind of a broad, quick overview to get a sense as to how waste pharmaceuticals are managed in each of the states and as a region. So we asked for the nature of pharmaceutical take-back collections in each state, the key barriers and key challenges, and then opportunities to increase support for drug take-back in the state and across the region. And then at the end, what I'd like you to do, you could, I don't know, write this down or think about it, but you know, you can hear a lot of information from, you know, 7 different people, right? A lot of stuff. So if you can think through, you know, what are the similarities that you're hearing? All right, what are some of the things that sound the same? What are some of the things that are different? Are there examples to follow? And maybe other important items that strike you. So I just want to kind of wrap it up at the end and try to bring it into a regional perspective.
Now with that,
this slide should look very familiar. Those on the phone were on Illinois Collection Day for slide.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Scott. Like Scott said, I moved to LA County, so I don't work with LA EPA, but I did back in the 80s, so I guess that gives me the standing that be up here and talk about the program. I did talk to Dave Walters with the IEPA and gave some information, so I'm going to share that with you now. The IEPA itself has about 40 water collection partners. They started this several years ago and they had more money, and that started really grow. They don't allow any more collection partners anymore now. They froze that program. They also fund 4 permanent EKW sites. We own and operate one of those. They're just now starting their one day events again. They've gotten some more funding. The longest time, if you didn't bring your materials to an HHW facility on all your work on the day events going on anywhere else in the state, so that was a problem. And according to the IEPA, they did collect, this is 2010 data, 149 drums and a cost of about $74,000. So they are using money that they get from the tax, if you will, the surcharge on a landfill. They do funnel some of that money to pay for the farms that are collected. There's another entity called Save a Star Foundation. This foundation was started by a couple in Highland Park who lost a son to a drug overdose. And they made it a mission of theirs to help law enforcement collect this material. So they've got 19 collection boxes in Illinois. I think 10 of those are in Lake County. And talking to the founder of that foundation, he told me that most, and I've talked to my local as well, a lot of them are holding on to the material until those EAAs and then they bring it there, or they're using their abandoned facility, which is a nice option they have. A lot of you may have heard of the P2E2 program. This was started by a high school teacher out in Pontiac, Illinois. It's got young kids involved in the collection of pharmaceuticals, so it's really a great model. And a lot of their partners were some of those collection partners on the FDA program. And based on the old data, I wasn't able to really get a lot of updated information on the P2E2 program, but it has gone international, and it's, I think, it's a good model for getting the youth involved in this issue as well. And then the last DA one-day event, I was told that I was a cast from Save a Star that we collect 11 tons of material. The key barriers, IEPA money is limited. It's based on landfill surcharge, which is driving the material out of our landfills. The Great Recession has changed our behavior, and there's not as much money, so that money source is limited. Local police, when it gains more costs to recover, I have 10 sites in my county, local law enforcement, but they really don't want me to put that on my website because they want to see this for their residents. They're afraid that they become known as the collection sites that they'll get material from all over inundated with that material. So, kind of a double-edged sword there. We want to have these collection sites, but at the same time, they don't want to get overwhelmed. So kind of to your point back
more could be done. We do have a law in Illinois that was passed a couple of years ago, and it's called the provisions of P2E2, and it created a fund, and there was a drug that said, so you got, you know, busted for marijuana or whatever, and you pay an extra $20 fine. And again, we're funding something on behavior we want to stop. And that part of the law as well is when they looked at what they thought they were generating, they thought they were generating hundreds of thousands of dollars for the fine. Well, 2 years after the fund we created, a couple $1,000. So that funding source is not very robust. They haven't started a grant program because they don't have the money. The grants could be given to only law enforcement and law. So really, it worked, it would have been, but it's not creating the money that we expected. And what more could be done? I think we did, in Lake County, we're home to some very large pharmaceutical companies. Abbott, Baxter, and Takeda, and Takeda, I had to work about Abbott and Baxter are. And Sarah Fletcher, when she was with PSI, we would talk to the pharmaceutical industry, trying to engage with them. And the bigger point, you know, it's not our problem. And, so we tried, and yeah, I guess we have to continue to try. So I'm going to pass the time to Lisa.
Before you do that, can you just explain what the Covanta option is, real quick?
The Covanta option is they're allowing local law enforcement to bring material to their waste energy facilities. No cost. So it's just the cost for the officer to go down there. But it's a great program. So that's next.
Thank you. Okay. Lisa, you're up. Lisa Payne Perez from Indiana, IDEM.
Good morning. I'm with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. And there we go. Might be a little small for those of you in the back, sorry. All right, so our basic program, and yeah, we're kind of scattered. We're working on creating a pilot program. At this time, I'm on our prescription drug abuse task force that our attorney general launched just last year. So we're probably catching up to some of you, but that's a typo. That's 2012, not 2013. A lot of our sheriff's offices do collect, in fact, I believe almost every county, but as somebody pointed out earlier, most of your police department when you could just go to your pharmacy. And then I'm also the liaison for our solid waste management districts, and I've visited many of them, and a good number of them have tried to start take-back programs. Some of them have succeeded better than others, and they have take-back the drop boxes that the Illinois Indiana Sea Grant funded. As some of you probably know, that's not really a huge source anymore for funding. So our districts are struggling to find ways to fund. And other current programs, some of our pharmacies are trying to participate, but because of the lack of regulation, it's difficult for them to really jump on board. They're nervous to do that. And some potential future programs, as I said, we're starting a pilot study, we hope, with the IU Health Hospital. Right now, that's just going to be more central Indiana, and then we hope to expand it to the entire state. And that will just be at the hospital set where they have pharmacies. And, you know, we wanted to include the controlled substances, obviously. I should point out, I'll get to it in a second, but obviously one of the challenges is transportation, and really that comes down to funding. So we are trying to partner with Medisure. They will hopefully transport both of these collections back up to Covanta's site in Indianapolis, where Covanta does accept it at no charge from residential waste. Okay, as I stated before, some of our challenges are funding and transportation. A lot of the counties that are not close to Indianapolis struggle with getting their medical waste down to Indianapolis, but up to us. That's a challenge. The sheriffs are usually more than happy to help, but again, that takes their manpower and money, so we have to figure that out. Of course, there's the DEA regulations that we're all waiting on to be finalized. General legislation, we are working on getting that a little bit more forward-thinking, and data collection, as somebody else mentioned too, it's pretty challenging to get it. I have all of the data for you on Indiana, because we don't have it. And then it's understandable, Covanta requires law enforcement that's at the site at the point of destruction for their liability, but that does mean that we need to have state, any kind of law enforcement present, so that again leads to somebody has to take out their time and money and resources to do that. All right, education and outreach was being offered. The Attorney General Office and our prescription drug task force are working on getting the word out about take back programs or other mail-in programs. My office item, we put everything online of how to properly dispose of waste, and we're trying to just beginning that relationship with the Attorney General to keep that moving forward. And yes, once we hopefully get that pilot program going, we are going to, the Attorney General will fund all the educational materials and support that pilot program to get the word out. As far as improvements, we are hoping to get a statewide drop-off program. We would love for the pharmacies to be able to do this. They're on board, they want to. It's just a matter of getting those regulations finalized, so that they're not penalized in some strange way. And as we've talked about, the EPR getting manufacturers and distributors to participate and then some of their responsibilities. And then I was amazed. I don't know if you have Marsh grocery stores in your state, but it's a local company for us. They are a huge proponent of doing take-back programs once a year. But they have a gigantic list of meds that they actually tell people to flush because they're so worried about, you know, the free value or the potential for misuse. They don't even want to accept it, so they just tell people to flush them. I think there's got to be a better way, so I hope that we can all work on that together. And we are working in Indiana on legislation. Just recently had a pill mill bill passed to try to decrease the amount of drugs that are being prescribed. It's a waste. People have mail-in, they don't use them. You know, somebody passes away, they've got 10 boxes of all of these meds from years they've never used. So I think starting at the source and reducing how much is actually being distributed is a good way to And then we had an idea, we're kind of batting around for some kind of potential tax incentive for distributors or pharmacies. That's still in the works, but it's just being talked about. With that, I will hand it over to you, Jennifer.
Not yet.
I know.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you very much. I guess we should be clapping, but after each one, that would be very good. And I'll clap to you too, Walter. Thank you. Consolidated clap, I guess. So I just wanted to draw your attention to this handout that you have, I think, here and also on your thumb drive. As Lisa was mentioning, there's a lot of data. And I want to thank Stephanie here for helping to coordinate and all of those that tried to fill out this form, because we're trying to really show, you know, what data do exist and what do we have, what don't we have, and this is a way to figure out how important it is to fill in the gaps of the data and then how much resources we all want to spend as a region to fill that in. But this is a starting place. If you see anything that you want to add to it, you know, please talk to Stephanie or any of the state people here if you have any questions. Take a look at that. We want to keep filling this out. This is kind of a draft, the first
my slides really brief, so there's not a whole lot, you know, different from Ohio from the first few that you've heard so far, other than what's left. Ohio doesn't have a lot. So I've got 171 locations up there now. This one actually keeps growing for me. I just discovered a website. I don't know how many other people knew about it. I sent it out to the farm waste listserv. It's called RX Drug Dropbox. I think it's through the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators, which is not called NADI normally. I found this recently, just last week when I was prepping for this conference. If you enter your zip code, for instance, you can find most of the ones, I believe, the way I understand it, is the sites that law enforcement that were provided a box by NADI. But it was a great tool for me to kind of get started on where the locations are in Ohio, and I was shocked to find out how many there were. I didn't know up until about a week and a half ago that there were that many locations in Ohio. So at first I was very excited. Then I heard a very good point this morning that actually how many people go to a law enforcement on their, you know, normal when they're running errands. So I was like, well, that's not so great then. It's good to know that we have so many locations. But obviously, like all the other states, we prefer to have them in pharmacies. Kind of a neater story. It's Lake County. I'm in Cleveland. Was one of the very first in Ohio. Just a few years ago, this has obviously grown very quickly, probably in the other states as well. They started this on their own through their health department, and they came to a local place in Ohio. We fortunately have two hazardous waste incinerators, so you can pay to keep the pharmaceuticals there. We don't have a Covanta, unfortunately. So they collected me, just to give you an idea, they got 4,000 pounds in 2012, and they paid about $4,000 for that. So it's not actually, you know, too much money in a county's, you know, funding for the year, but that just gives you a good idea of one county in Ohio. The number you saw on our handout already, but this is just the number from the most recent collection. I have checked out on all of the collections so far, and that's probably our biggest so far. I remember the DEA rules was our biggest barrier. I thought it was the Department of Justice. I didn't like those here, but that's obviously our little tempy humor there. We haven't done much as a government. I worked on a guidance document going back to 2008. We started working on this. This is when I started working on it, and we created a guidance document way back then, so that counties that were having collections knew what they had to do according to the DEA and where they could destroy them. In Ohio, we have a lot of options for that. So we kind of have a guidance document of sorts. Similar to Illinois, we have an attorney general involved because we also had a spilled mail bill, we called it, but our bill was more about cutting down. We were having so much drug abuse in southern Ohio that the bill was more about cutting down on how much could get used, I guess. It was more just to try and cut down how much is out there. And through that bill, they also require the attorney general to kind of provide collections. So they have given drop boxes to a lot of southern Ohio counties. I believe that we could use some funding in Ohio, certainly. We work a lot with our Department of Natural Resources group that gives out funds or grants. And I know that working through them, we could provide the permanent collection boxes that don't, the places that don't already have them, and to get them in pharmacies eventually, that would be one process. And then obviously the legislation would be awesome, but they can't even get an e-waste bill passed in Ohio, so I don't think we're going to be doing that anytime soon. So that was Ohio.
Okay. Thank you very much. So Steve Brock is going to come up here because we're all working so hard on these issues that it's good to pause to recognize a colleague who has done great things. And here's an achievement we wanted to acknowledge. As I mentioned before, my co-conspirator, Laura Victor, is well known in Wisconsin for the fine work she's done with medical waste, but it goes way beyond that. This year, she was the recipient of a very prestigious award of the BMI, the Rebecca Wallace Memorial Award, which is given to an employee who not only exemplifies excellence in the
type of environmental work she's providing, but is so dedicated and well-rounded as a whole variety of other things in terms of community service, taking care of the family, really being supportive. I'm happy to announce that the board chair was Barbara Pickford-Barbary.
I didn't know Becky Wallace when she worked at DNR. I didn't know her when I was a teenager in Minnesota. Grew up near where Jennifer and I did. But one thing I learned from her kids is that she was able to elicit cooperation by having a very simple message. In her case, it was clean water. We want clean water. And I think in this case, we could have a slogan, something like clean water and clean kids. Well, what we have in Wisconsin is we're actually wanting to have this report that the UW Center and PSI created for us. I don't have enough copies. I actually only have one copy here. I have the summary. I have a few copies of those, so afterwards, one of them can get one. Interested if you don't have it. The full report is available online. But one thing we discovered is that most of the typical program in Wisconsin is run by law enforcement, and they are available in most of our counties. Forget the exact percentage, but all but three of them. And they're increasingly open year round, and they are funded primarily by local governments and some by state federal governments, such as this GLRA grant. So the percentage that is run by, maybe hard to see here, but the darker purple at the bottom is one-day collections, then an equal number in 2010 to 2011, but there's a great increase in the number of permanent collections, which is the light in the middle purple, and then a little slice at the top. That's there. A little slice at the top, which is where that mail-back program that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funded. We found, in 2010, we collected 45 tons or 50,000 pounds. In 2011, 47 tons or almost 100,000 pounds. And the DEA collected in Wisconsin in 2012, 30 tons in two events. And then this year, just in the first event alone, collected 23 tons. So Wisconsin is collecting quite a lot. But did we collect all of it? As we mentioned before, now we did the report that was found that estimated that about 13 million pounds per year are sold in Wisconsin pharmaceuticals. Of those, we estimate about a third go unused, and that means there's 4.5 million pounds per year that's wasted, and of that 4.5 million, we only collected. Just based on the literature, one thing we had, very little time to do the study, so we didn't have time to actually research that. We just went on with the available data. So anyone who's interested in data collection, looking at, really, is that 1/3 a good estimate or not? Let us know. Okay, our challenges that were identified are similar to what other people have mentioned, the destruction, public awareness, or our regulations, funding and data collection. So I just want to mention what our state has done. There's been initiatives that I've been involved with in DNR. Our air program permitted a industrial boiler to burn pharmaceuticals, and they did for a while, and then they kind of got scared and backed off from doing that. So currently in Wisconsin, we have no places to send our drugs. We have to ship them out of state for destruction. We did collaborate with the pharmacy society for flyers, providing assistance messages, as I mentioned before. We've posted a lot of guidance on our website, not only for the public, but also for collecting drugs, so that it's really clear what they can and cannot do. And then we've advocated, we did comment to the DEA on their rules, with many of the same comments that Margaret
phenomenal. Thank you very much. That was really a lifesaver for me. And we've been working with the Pharmaceutical Waste Working Group and developing the Pharmaceutical Waste Reduction website. I forgot to mention before that we have one part of that website is dedicated to how people at home can reduce pharmaceutical waste. And Chris Miller helped draft that and it's really excellent resource. So I hope you do go out and look at it because it turns out there's a lot more that people can do at home than. And the main thing is to give them permission to question the doctor about what they're being prescribed. And other initiatives from Wisconsin, there's that drug, good drug cost ad that I mentioned, Jason Weber and Tom and Ashley developed that. And Jefferson County has been avoiding drug runs out of state for how many years, Sarah? There are many, many take-back programs and pharmacy initiatives to help with the prescribing of medication. And then grants. We have a program that was funded to give grants to counties to look at the whole issue. So all of the recommendations that were put out by the State Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse will be implemented in 9 counties. So not just the collection, but also having to do with the law enforcement. And then we also have measures right here in our room that has developed a shot box, which is back in the back of the room. I want to take a look at it. That's it for
Wisconsin. Thanks, Barb. And I like the names of these programs, the good drugs. John, do you have a comment?
I'd actually want to ask Barbara a question, because when you were mentioning about the issues about prescribing of drugs, I've noticed many products today seem to be short dated expiration. And I'm wondering how many people are like, oh, it's a year, it's done, and let me go order another prescription. Yes, the drug's probably quite good. Do you have any thoughts on that part of sort of getting more value over what we've already invested in drugs that are in our cupboards?
I'm going to stand over next to this phone.
Okay.
Try this one. And see, the members of the partnership will get that
discussion
before the actual Q&A period.
Don't worry.
I'm
telling you. I'm going to be really honest and say, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be something that any of us in this room has much control over. And I don't know why you're short-dated like that. Maybe German, that one. The drug companies have to do stability studies, and so they have to guarantee that the drug is good through that date. The newer drugs, you're going to have shorter stability studies that have been done, but they're not going to put a 5-year dating on a product that just came out, because they probably haven't even done all the stability. Now, I'm not necessarily dissenting with that. The only reason for it, and that gets into the politics of drug manufacturing, and I'm not going to go there. But certainly, as pharmacists, we have to be extremely careful that we not only don't dispense beyond that particular date, but even beyond use now, which is different from when I was first starting. Right? Do you want to address that, Russ?
Charlotte, you wanted to state who you were?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Charlotte Smith with Pharmacology Services, Priority for National Healthcare Solutions. Thank you.
I'm retired, so I can make the comments, I guess.
And you're retired from where?
I'm retired from Needham St. Mary's in Madison and part of the Mitra
again for
program. So I'm Russ Jensen. And there's no incentive for drug companies to put a long expiration date on it. And for one reason, it's economic, but the other reason, you're supposed to take them. And the medication that's prescribed is was taken within a limited period of time and then not needed anymore. So there's really a couple of reasons there. And I know the federal government has been looking at taking a drug and can it be extended. But I don't know if we've had much data, information to come out yet. Do you have any other?
You'd have to come up and if you could
speak in the vicinity of this microphone here, I'm sorry to ask you to do that. State your name.
My name is Donald Lester, and I'm a pharmacist at UW in Madison. And my background is in toxicology. I spent 25 years with the Poison Center within Madison, staffing and managing. A lot of what you'll see when the expiration date on products refers to storage conditions. And that means that in the original manufacturer's container, on the shelf, in controlled temperatures in your pharmacy, it's good until a certain date. When people take them home and they put it in the medicine cabinet and they store them in their vehicles and they put them in their pockets, that expiration date may not even be valid. And so knowing where the product is stored and the conditions may also affect the length of time that they might be fully coated. So that's just another, you know, another thought.
Thank you. So the answer is, okay, we're going to go to the phones now, and Stephanie, you're going to move the slide. So, Chad, are you there? Chad Rogers from Michigan DEQ?
Yep, morning, Scott. Can you hear me okay?
I can, great. So my little notes here said Chad is planning to participate, but in the event his wife goes into labor, he will not be participating.
Yep.
So I understand. I hope your wife has not gone into labor at this point.
Not that I know of. Not yet, anyway.
I hope it's at the right time, and we all wish you and your wife and your family the best. But so this could be a kind of a different kind of diversion, maybe, speaking here at this conference. So you're up.
Okay, well, good morning, Milwaukee. You can skip over my first two slides, the DEQ mission and the guiding principles, and I'll just kind of give you the high-level view of kind of the pharmaceuticals in Michigan. And so we don't really know the extent of our take-back programs or who's taking what back or where. We don't really have a handle on that. It's kind of spontaneously develops in various counties, it seems like. And we don't really have a good information gathering network or anything. But we do know that several communities have detected pharmaceuticals in their source and wastewater. And then the amount, what we do know about our collections is that the DEA worked with 197 sites to do their collection events last year, and they got nearly 20,000 pounds in 2012. And then we have a statewide organization, the Yellow Jugs Old Drugs Program. They're a nonprofit organization that works with pharmacies, and the pharmacies become members, and they pay, I think, a $300 a year fee to have Yellow Jugs Old Drugs give them jugs to collect for people to drop their pharmaceuticals off, and then the Yellow Jugs program goes and picks those up four times a year. And between September 2012 and May 2013, last year, they collected 23,000 pounds. And this organization started up in 2009, and they've done about 33 tons of drugs since they started. And they're statewide. They have coverage over most of the state. There's some areas in the northern Upper Peninsula that they don't have coverage in based on their maps that they have online, but they have pretty good coverage around the state, and they take all their drugs to an incinerator and have them incinerated. And we do know that, like I said earlier, many counties have collection days, or some of them have ongoing collection programs. Some cities do it too, but we just don't have a handle on who and where is doing that right now. If you can switch to the next slide. So the DEQ in Michigan, we recognize that pharmaceuticals are an emerged issue. You know, we think it's something that we need to pay attention to, and we've been looking at it for a while, and we're focusing some of our resources on it right now. So over the past 3 years, we partnered to produce a pharmaceutical waste best management guidebook for healthcare professionals, and that's geared towards a hospital setting to help them manage their pharmaceutical waste better. And that really came out of some compliance issues some of our hospitals were having, so we wanted to partner with them so they could better understand our waste rules and also better manage their pharmaceutical waste. And then we're currently working with five different organizations to support collections throughout the state, and the Yellow Jugs Group is one of those organizations. And all of the grants have a marketing and outreach component, and the Yellow Jugs Group is doing a statewide marketing and outreach effort. They're producing public service announcements that are going to be played at a space available basis on public radio stations. They're producing a 30-minute documentary on the pharmaceutical problem in Michigan that's going to be aired on all 8 of our public television stations this fall. They're also translating a lot of our materials into Spanish and Arabic. We have one of the highest Arabic populations in the Arabic-speaking populations in the country. So they're, you know, translating our materials so everybody can understand and gain from the outreach materials. And they're also working with an organization to make the documentary available to persons with disabilities. So they're going to do closed captioning and stuff like that. And we're also looking at awarding some more grant money this year. We recently issued an RFP to get some more coverage throughout the state, get some more organizations involved. And we have to work with our front office before we can really announce that, but we hope to be able to do that in the next month. And I should mention, all these groups we're working with also are deploying collection resources, so drop boxes or collection days. If it's a really rural area, they do, you know, collection days. But so every organization we work with has a collection component. And we're also working with stakeholders to try to engage them in product stewardship geared dialogues. And we're doing those. We're going to be wrapping that up in the next 3 months. We've done most of the dialogues already, but we're doing some kind of callback conference calls for people to review the report that we produced. And that's through one of our pollution prevention grants also. And if you want to go to the next slide. So I guess this is my opinion, our barriers, and these are also kind of our opportunities, I think, on some levels. So I think there's an education barrier, and that's why we are focusing on our outreach campaigns with our grantees. We want the average person to understand how they should handle their unused pharmaceuticals and what the risks to the environment and themselves are if they don't properly handle those materials. We want to deploy more collection resources, and by that I mean drop boxes, or if the community isn't right for a drop box, at least have a periodical collection day, collection event. We are also, stakeholder participation is a barrier. In some of our dialogues, we've had a hard time getting the drug industry there. Right? Well, actually, we haven't had a hard time. We haven't gotten the drug industry there to directly participate in the dialogue. So that's an issue. We don't really know. I don't think we really know how to kind of combat that and get them there. We think their strategy is probably just not to participate is the best strategy they can think of to protect their interests. But I don't really know how to handle that one yet. The DEA regulations. Proposed regulations they issued, I think it was earlier this spring, to make it legal for the pharmacists to accept controlled substances. My take on those is that they have delayed some organizations from participating in drug collections because they're unsure of how the regulations are actually going to shake out, and until they're finaled, they don't want to step into the drug collection world. Prior to the draft regulations being issued by DEA, we were in some talks with Walmart in Michigan they expressed interest in implementing drug collection programs at their pharmacies. And then once the draft regulations were issued, those talks kind of slowed down, and we haven't really heard anything from them. So I think once those are finaled, maybe that our relationship will change, and maybe we can have some progress there. And then our state waste rules have a unique barrier because they actually create, in our state, based on our state waste rules, drug collection locations are technically not compliant with the waste rules because they are treated like a transfer station. And our drug collection groups are operating under an enforcement discretion letter from our director. So they, he basically said, we're not going to take any enforcement action because we agree with what you're doing. So we're trying to push through some changes to our waste rules. They died in our legislature last year. I think they've been reintroduced this year, but they haven't gone anywhere. And though we call those rules our diversion rules, or the rule changes, because basically we're going to make it easier to divert certain wastes from the landfill to a higher or a better type of final disposition. So what we can do on our end is continue to push those, work with our legislature to push those rules through. And, you know, we can always do more grant money, but grant money is a temporary solution. And, you know, you can't really plan a long-term drug collection solution based on a two-year grant. So that, it's pretty much the state of affairs in Michigan. So I'll take any questions if you have any.
Okay, thanks, Chad. We're going to hold just a little bit on the questions until Scott and then goes, and then also Jennifer. So if you can stick around, that would be great.
Yep.
If you're not around here, we may know why. But give Chad a big hand. Our next speaker is Scott Stoner. Scott is at the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. Scott, it says in my private notes here you have 20 children, and because of that you may not be able to participate today. I guess you're with us.
No, only two.
All right. Good. Go. You got the slides up, and Stephanie's advancing them.
Great. Great. Thanks. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Well, good morning, everybody there in Milwaukee. Good morning. Speaking to you from Albany, New York, and the main focus of what we've been working on, and I'll talk about, are addressing the collection of household drugs, although I will talk a little bit about drugs from long-term care facilities as well. And one of the advantages of going last is to be able to hear how much all of the states are facing the same hurdles, the same barriers, the same issues, and really how similar our approaches are. And I think I've heard six great talks about very smart and innovative and dedicated approaches to this. So glad to be part of this. So if we could jump ahead to slide 63, and we'll come back to that poster at the end. It's the one that says New York State collection of drugs.
Yes, we're on that.
Okay, thanks. So we at the New York State DEC we promote and facilitate the collections of household drugs. We have created a set of procedures and posted that on our website on how a group can set up a collection event. We promote the DEA's biannual now national collection events, and those have been very successful in New York State. Statewide, or across the state, I should say, we've had collections as part of household hazardous waste days, some collection events by the New York City Sanitation Department. There are drop boxes at state police stations across the state, sheriff's offices, local police. There are collection events at sheriff's offices, some at pharmacies that have involved law enforcement, and including the two DEA events, last year collected more than 84,000 pounds of drugs across the state. The New York City watershed is a large area north of New York City, kind of between Albany and New York City. And there's a pilot program there involving a number of long-term care facilities where our agency, under the direct participation and supervision of either our law enforcement or New York City DEP, Department of Environmental Protection law enforcement, actually goes around to various long-term care facilities and picks up drugs and takes them for incineration. That's been very successful, and I think that's a model that could be expanded to other parts of the state. The next one, which should be 64, please.
Got it.
The barriers are probably, again, similar to that in other states. while we do have a fairly good network of collections, collection sites and events, they're nowhere near enough. I really think we're, you know, the 84,000 pounds is just getting a drop in the bucket. And when the DEA regs are finalized, we hope that that will expand or be able to expand collections to pharmacies, because we believe that permanent pharmacy-based collections where people go every week is the perfect solution to this. Another barrier is simply the cost of transportation, and now also quite likely the cost of law enforcement personnel to staff events to collect controlled substances. At the long-term care facilities, we desperately need some alternative to flushing, some type of method to render them unrecoverable at the site other than flushing that can be approved. And we are hopeful that the new DEA regs will at least include the pharmacy provided collection boxes at these facilities, because we think this is a major source of drugs that is going unaddressed. For the past 5 years, we've had a very active Don't Flush Your Drugs campaign. We have a dedicated website that's on my title slide, press releases, posters, flyers, articles, talks such as this one, various media interviews, and a law in New York State that's been on the books, I think, about 3 years. It actually requires veterinary offices, grocery stores that sell drugs, even over-the-counter drugs, and pharmacies to post a notice like the one, if you could go back to slide 62, please. And we have worked actively to help implement that. It carries the don't flush message. The primary recommendation is to return for collection, or how to dispose of them in trash if it's not safe or practical to bring them back for collection. And it refers to that's our dedicated website that lists upcoming collection events and additional information. Well, happy to take questions, I think, during the Q&A session. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Jennifer Wolfman from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And then ask Jennifer to speak, if I could ask you all to just come up here.
I may spend a little bit, see how you're doing. I know the room is probably in some air here. We need a break soon, but we haven't had a chance to interact yet. So you'll need a mic. And when I use this one.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, everybody. How are you doing? Good to be here. Okay, so I got my slides in late for their effort presentation. We started out in Minnesota. The Western Lake Superior Sanitary District had a C grant in 2007, and they collected about 500 pounds of pharmaceuticals. And that same year, we had our first permanent collection site start up in Chisago County. And 2008 and 9, we didn't do a whole, there were a few sites that started, and then we had a champion in the law enforcement area that went around and spoke at different sheriff's groups and talked to them about the value of collecting because of the abuse issue. And then we had a whole lot of interest, and it's really taken off since then. We gained a lot of sites last year in 2012 that they just kind of started collecting, so I think our numbers hopefully double next year. And it looks our total, with including the DEA events, is up to whatever it shows on the chart there, close to 45,000. So we're doing pretty good for quantities collected. I was just looking back at the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District data and to see see, since they started their events in 2007, what the numbers have looked like each year. And they're pretty steady. There isn't like a line in the amount collected, like everybody got rid of them. You know, it's a pretty steady, consistent number continuing to be collected. When we started the program in 07, actually, Chicago started and Whistle did before we sort of had our guidance developed. But we got together with DEA, the Board of Pharmacy, the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and then the Pollution Control Agency where I work. And we wanted to come up with a guidance that would allow for collection of controlled substances. We wanted to start a collection program to have it be in compliance with all the existing regulations. So we don't have, and luckily law enforcement stepped up to the plate on that, and I think we might have more permanent law enforcement. I've seen a lot of people, and it really was because one of their own went off and promoted it, and we certainly appreciate that. So we have, oh, I have another slide.
Unless you're not done with this.
All right, so there's our numbers. We have 128 law enforcement sites. We expect probably to get another 20 or 30 in this year. And then we have health partners who are very interested in collecting. So we said, what the heck, give it a try. They don't collect controlled substances, but they're starting. And hopefully from them, we can get some models together for pharmacies to collect. Our Board of Pharmacy is not super interested in having pharmacies collect, and they're also very busy. So I have to be able to kind of push at it every once in a while and say, we can get started. We can get started. If rules are coming, and your pharmacies are going to want to collect. I don't know if any of the big chains will, but the little guys will, the mom and pops will. We know that typically happens. So we need to get ahead of it. And my one spare time, we'll push on that some more. But so the other thing, and I wanted to mention this, I'll just mention it now, maybe out of order, is the Board of Pharmacy and the National kind of Board of Pharmacy, the National Pharmacists Association, they feel that if product stewardship legislation passes, they will be required, pharmacies will be required to collect. And I'm trying to explain that to the board, and I think I've done that in our state, and to the Pharmacists Association, that no product stewardship language has ever required any retailer to collect this. But it's a rumor that's out there. I've seen it in some of their printed materials. It's a big concern, and we have to make sure that we articulate that that is not the case, product stewardship. Aside from that, we do know that retail will be interested in collecting. But just to point there, you can be aware of. I'm not sure if you speak with your Board of Pharmacy or Pharmacists Association, but when you're considering legislation, you certainly want to make sure they understand that. So we have, well, those are our statistics up there. Hennepin County does events, and they've done some at senior housing locations, which has worked out pretty well for them. I don't know. Leonard is here, so we'll talk about that some more later. We have one small pharmacy that every year does an event. A lady that she thinks it's important, she'll collect 30 pounds, or I think she had a high of 200 pounds last time. So, but she'll be one of the first out of the gate to collect if we ever get the, when the DEA regulations are finalized. In Minnesota, also, the first barrier that we encountered right off the bat, which was identified with WLSSD and their C grant, they had to haul their controlled substances to an incinerator in Ohio, and that cost like a police officer and a whole deal. It was maybe $3,000 to $5,000. That barrier was identified, and we had to get work right away on addressing that. So we thought about how we could permit our waste-to-energy facilities for disposal, and we figured out how to do that actually through our household hazardous waste rule. And so we have five that are currently permitted. One just went down for, I don't know if they're going to come back up again, but they were needed to redo the incinerator maintenance thing. And then we have a couple of large incinerators that I'd love to see accept pharmaceuticals, but one of them is going through permitting issues right now. That was their work difficult in the neighboring community. And the other one, I just need to go down there and make them start, I think. But because a lot of ours are located in the northern part of the state, just as I messed with this morning. So we there are three of us are only hazardous waste incinerator in the state, and they agreed as part of their permitted expansion to take all of the controlled substances that were confiscated by law enforcement versus what they collect in one household, one business. So 3M takes that portion for free. How much really goes to the 3M for disposal versus the waste energy facilities? I don't know. In reality, what's, we don't know what's in the drums, but that opportunity is there. So this is, the blues really all mean the same thing. They're just different colors. no good reason anymore. some were pending, and I think we had a difference for color and pending and not pending. The darkest boxes were the ones, at, some of the ones added in 2012. But we have, you'll see on the map that there are some things that are, they're stars. So up there in the northwest in Polk County, that's one of the waste-to-energy facilities. Now, all of the waste in that county goes to that waste-to-energy facility, so they decided to tell the people that live in that county to, you know, wrap the stuff up and put it in the garbage because it's going to go to the incinerator anyway. They don't feel like they need to go through the extra expense to collect separately. Otter Tail County, same situation, but they have collection anyway. Polk County is another one of our incinerators, and they don't have separate collection, and neither does Olmsted. So they just, they direct people to put their pharmaceuticals in the trash. Bloor County is where our other facility is located. And then Hennepin County has a large waste-to-energy facility. So if we could get Olmsted and Hennepin to accept, then we'd have good coverage. Because right now, the Bloor facility only takes really small quantities, so people have to drive up to the, you know, the north part of the state. Well, we're doing pretty good. I think the disposal is maybe a dollar a pound. Oh, wrap it up. Okay. Yeah. we've got some grants, but basically no funding. We've given out a just tiny speck of money. I don't see that continue. The DDA covers the disposal cost a couple times a year if they can get their stuff in at that point. And so we still do have some that shipped with the halfway contract. I'm not exactly sure why. We had legislation that was introduced in 2010, but that really didn't go anywhere. Do I have another slide? I'd like to try it again. I'm not here on official state business because my travel is denied, so it just says JB would try it again, and it's just me. if we get the DEA regulations this year sometime, that would be great. The DCA, we register the site, we collect data, we do technical assistance, we have a guidance document workshop, and then we permit the waste-to-energy facilities. We is pretty much all me, except now I have somebody else doing the registering the site. And then, that's it for that. Is there anything else we mentioned? Probably not. Any questions? Oh, you do that part, right? Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'll take both of them. Why don't you come up here? Let me just ask,
how are people feeling right now? We're supposed to have a break at 11. I feel like we need at least 15 minutes of Q&A. We can do that now and then take a break. Are we ready? Okay. So come on up, everyone. And I'm going to be passing the mics around. We're going to hopefully get the good mics. And those on the phone, you are very lucky because you are sitting right in front of our panel. And you'll be able to hear them really good. And I'm going to need a runner with this mic over here.
Can you do that?
Sure. I'll give you two mics.
Which works?
I don't know. You got to figure it out.
Blinded by the light.
Blinded by... Oh,
front? Because that's awful.
Oh, okay.
So you want to do that, or you want to power it down?
We don't do that.
Questions or comments from the floor? Yes, right back here.
Hello, I'm Mary Allen with the Solid Waste Agency of Northern County, Illinois, representing 23 municipalities just south of Lake County where Walter is. And this actually isn't for the panel. I'm going to put John from Covanta on the spot. But it ties into a comment that, while I know I did it, Walter had mentioned the Covanta option. In Plank Region, our 23 municipalities are all collecting 2007 pharmaceuticals that are not controlled. Some of our police stations have the 24/7 drop-off mailbox to use the STAR program, work with the DEA take-back. And I've been working, I talked with Mr. Katz with the Save the STAR program and also the DEA Illinois representative to see how maybe in the Swank region we could complement the municipal drop-off with more police drop-offs. And they both had said to me that they were not sure about the commitment from Covanta to move forward. So I wondered if you maybe could comment on that for those of us that utilize that Indianapolis facility.
Hopefully those on the phone have heard the question for John Wassenschmidt from Covanta about Covanta's acceptance of waste pharmaceuticals and incineration of that waste energy plants around the country. John?
The short answer is that there is no sunset provision at this time. I have relatively good support in the company to continue, so I think, now, I guess I would interpret that as we've got at least another 2 or 3 years before I think any kind of question would come up, and it may well go on forever, but I did have a little bit of a challenge addressing the economic issues when we started the program, but like I say, I've got support from so many parts of the company that recognize the value of it as a public service that there's nobody raising the question, or very few people raising the question about whether or not we should continue. So I think planning standpoint, and I think, someplace in the 2-3 year, that's realistic, confident planning. I don't see any issues with it coming up, and I would expect it would go longer than that, and probably if I'm willing to keep working, it'll just keep going on.
Thank you.
Other questions for our panelists here or those on the phone? Any similarities? Remember, what we were looking at, you got a lot of data, right? A lot of information from all the different states. You have a pretty good sense what you're hearing. There were some comments about things that were the same. What things were the same? What things are different? What are you hearing from all the different programs?
Hi, Henry Antel with CSB Environmental. Oftentimes, I don't have a chance to have the same regulators here to ask the question, too. So, we're in the hazardous waste business, and a certain percentage of pharmaceuticals are hazardous. And that's always been a challenge that our customers have had as far as proper segregation of control to non-haz to haz. So, oftentimes with HHW, there are exemptions for consumer waste. But some of our corporate clients, corporate retail pharmacies, corporate pharmaceutical distributors, et cetera, would like to support programs like this, but they don't want to either change their generator status or there's questions as far as can they take consumer waste and do they need to worry about the RCRA portion of that. So I guess I'm just asking for feedback and commentary on that portion of the challenge.
Let me ask the panel here, you can raise your hand if you'd like to respond. Or those on the phone, Scott or Chad, any comments?
So it was really hard to hear the question, sorry.
Oh boy. So that's really a shame. I guess we're gonna have to run regulatory guy. It's about regulations about the household and
versus business.
We have the environmental here, changes come up. They'll hear you if you stand right here.
Right there.
Speak into the phone.
Testing.
Go ahead.
Hi, do you have me?
Hello.
Yeah.
All right.
So we take a lot of pharmaceuticals back now. Currently, about 90%+ of them are non-HAZ, but a certain percentage of them are HAZ. And, of course, that's from industry, and I know oftentimes consumers have HHW exemptions. But some of our retail pharmacy customers, corporate customers that would like to participate in this potentially are worried about changes to their generator status and whether they can actually, you know, accept HHW waste, you know, and not change their generator status and accept a large percentage, or do they have to worry about segregation challenges? So I'm asking those in the regulating community to perhaps give me some insight to that.
I probably have an easy answer. I'm not a regulator, so I can't really answer it.
All right, we've got a comment here. Jennifer?
Hi, this is Jennifer Holman from Minnesota, and that answer might vary from state to state. I know in Minnesota the way we design our program is that if you want to collect consumer or household quantities and you are a hospital or, you know, that generates the business quantities, you can do that without increasing your generator size, and you can commingle and ship all those together. But that's for Minnesota. It might be different for others.
Does anyone in the audience also have some comments that want to come up? Because if you, now we're going to get you up out of your seats, and you may get some less blowing. So we're going to have you up here if you can. Really, it's okay. These folks will hear you better. John, you want to talk about that?
And you have John Watson first from Covanta after. Barb, you want to go first?
No, John.
You guys go ahead.
They're right here.
Oh, okay. Well, in Wisconsin, currently under state law, it's on the books, it says that you would have to, anything collected from households then falls back into regulation. But we have an enforcement discretion for pharmaceuticals, so it remains excluded from federal regulation. As long as it's done in a certain way, which is environmental.
I was just going to address the non-residential, because the household hazardous waste exemption, as it exists today, is not available for businesses, and I think there's a simple solution to it, which is to make all pharmaceuticals by legal definition non-hazardous, and then that problem would go away. And so we had testified to this point to the DEA and to the EPA, and realize, depending on what view you take of a nursing home, it either is residences or it's a business. So the question is actually very valid, and I think the number that I've seen is 5 to 7% of pharmaceuticals could be classified as hazardous. That sounds a little high to me, but that's a number that's in the literature. But that's the way we can solve that problem. And if you're willing to accept thermal destruction under the maximum achievable control technology, whether it's a medical waste facility, an energy from waste facility, or a hazardous waste facility, you basically have the same service at all of those locations. And I think the idea is to move product to ultimate non-retrievable destruction, and that's the way to get there, to answer your – and I can give you copies of the stuff in your card.
Morning. My name is John Storling. I'm the Director of Retail Sector Services for CB&I. We are a consulting engineering company. My clients are national retailers. And this is to the nub of their problem in the sense of the complexity of the regulations, the multiple jurisdictions, the multiple states. John, the EPA will not accept just a blanket reclassification out of hazardous waste definition. It would have to be on an item-by-item basis, have some scientific basis, either in the characteristics of material or the way it's managed. There's ubiquity as of universal waste, but still considering hazard and so forth. The retailers, I think, would be very interested in participating in take-back programs if there was some regulatory relief on waste and DEA issues around it. Not necessarily that they don't want to protect the environment. I mean, they definitely want to protect the environment, and they want to protect our communities from street use of pharmaceuticals, but there needs to be some consistency. So we have 50 states, we have, and many of you are, or a few of you are represented here. that have various regulations. We have certain counties and regional areas that may be more restrictive. This is very difficult, very challenging for multi-site entities that may have several hundred or sites in the state, may have a dozen sites in the county. It's just incredibly onerous to develop compliance programs and manage these kinds of things. So to take on pharmaceutical take-back is a huge problem for us at this point. Now, the EPA will be issuing a notice of data availability by the end of the summer on reverse logistics and hazardous waste, including they want to solicit comments on pharmaceuticals and over-the-counters in reverse logistics. And that's exactly what we're talking about here, or it's related to it. Reverse logistics, more strictly, might be considered, you know, returning it to the manufacturer for credit. But ultimately, it's all disposed. And some agencies, California in particular, has been looking at that in terms of if you know it's being destroyed, it's a waste at the point of generation, you have to handle it as a hazardous waste as well as a controlled substance. In fact, in consent agreements with the state of California, the last four targeting retailers, Safemart, Walgreens, CVS, and Costco, the district attorneys and the state of California included some injunctive relief requirements on the retailers to work on reverse logistics and record issues, including pharmaceuticals over-the-counters, through their trade association. I know Scott, through the Retail Industry Leaders Association, we're working very hard on this issue. And it is very important that we get as many voices speaking on this NOTA, Notice of Data Availability, when it comes out from the US EPA, so that this issue maintains priority in the agency during time and budget sequesters and other pressures, other political pressures on the agency. It meets with President Obama's regulatory relief priorities, and but still it's important that we get data. And this group, what I've heard so far this morning, I think has a lot to say on this issue and can help move, keep this issue moving forward in order of having regulatory relief. And if the EPA can develop some more realistic rules around this, I think many of the states or most of the states will follow. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We are...
consider universal waste? Didn't EPA consider at one time calling pharmaceuticals a universal waste?
It backed
off.
Is that a permanent backoff?
Because
that's not going to give you traction.
All right.
So looking at the time, 7:15, I'm about 15 minutes over the break. I see a little eerie faces, so I think we're going to take a break here. Before you do, I just want to thank our sponsors, which I was negligent of doing earlier. I want to thank MedReturn, Mike Mayer, and that. I want to encourage you all to check out their system. And Mike, after the break, why don't we give you 5 minutes to just discuss your system? Right after when people come back. Well, I thank you very much for helping us to sponsor this meeting. And I also want to thank Carter Anderson and Verde. They have a booth right next door there. Two solutions here for the pharmaceutical waste issue. And we'll give you 5 minutes too. When you come back here, please be on time. And let's thank them for helping to sponsor this meeting.
Mike Meyer from MedReturn is with us today. We met not too long ago, and we're happy to learn that Mike's business is right in our backyard in McLaren, Wisconsin, which is about 20 miles away. Yeah, if we can all get close to the telephone, hopefully they'll be able to hear us better.
Oh, Mike. Okay, well, it's an honor to be here. We have been a member of PSI now for a couple of years. MedReturn is an organization, actually our core business, we do in-store displayed interactive kiosks for retail. And approximately 6 years ago, we had a program internally called WIT, which I thought that, where individuals in our organization would come up with ideas that would help at the time of the downturn hopefully supplements are some of the ongoing business. This was an idea by a gentleman in our company of collecting these pharmaceutical prescription drugs from households. And as we started to dig into this issue, we realized that not only was it a big problem, but there were really very few solutions out there where people could take those prescription drugs. So our initial, because we come from the retail industry, our initial thought was we would take this to pharmacies. And so we've made a number of presentations to pharmacies, but also to other pharmaceutical companies as well. One very large fast food restaurant organization as well. We've exhibited at the IACP show, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the last 3 years, also the National Drug Summit. And everywhere we have gone, especially to the retailers, everybody said, what a great idea. Unfortunately, with the retailers and the pharmaceutical companies, when it got to their legal department, they said, let's stop. At the IACP show, we also heard the same thing. Most of the time we heard, what a great idea. And I've broken it into thirds. A third of the police department or the chiefs said, great idea, I want this in my community. A third said, let's see where it goes. And the third said, I'm not touching that. And I think that's where we're still going. 6 years ago, I think we were at the very forefront of this issue, but it has now become and labeled an epidemic. And as we have continued to work in within MedReturn, we've been fortunate that there are at least 900 communities that see the benefit of placing these units. And we've got that over 45 some odd states, even Alaska. And even within our own county as well, Ozaukee County, Gail Bruss is here with Starting Point with CATCA, who helped fund the units and place them in six different police departments within our local area. But if I do my math correctly, at least there are 20 to 25,000 communities across the country, and there will be the need for not only the take-back day collection boxes, the unit and the product that Verity has come up with as well. And as we're becoming an older society and a more medicated society, this problem is just going to continue to go. So it's become a passion within our organization as well, and we're just happy to be a part of this, hopefully a part of the solution.
Thanks, Wayne. This mic, and we'll be right next to the We'll be right next to the who wants to start? Carter or Jason?
I can start.
Okay,
Carter.
Hi, I'm Carter Anderson with Verde Environmental Technologies in Minneapolis. Want to say hello to everyone and thanks for putting on a great program for us here. We're learning a lot. I'm going to tag team with my partner Jason here. But what we have is a supplement to disposal programs, but our mission is to create at source the activation mechanism so people can get rid of the drug at the source, at the place where that drug is first noted as an excess. And I'll start with the genesis of the idea. I'm a chemist by training. I'm not a public speaker. But I was in the pharmaceutical industry and developing transdermal patches. And one of the problems of transdermal patches that most of you are probably aware is that there's a lot more drug loading in these patches than what's delivered into the body during the normal wear period. As much as 90% or maybe more of the original content of those patches is still in the patch. Well, we came up with an idea on how to destroy that residual drug in our patch, and we realized it would not only apply to our patch but to all manufacturers' patches, and we applied for a patent on it. And we realized this problem of unused medications isn't just patches, but pills and liquids and other forms as well. So we expanded our patent application. And what we ultimately did is we licensed out from our manufacturer or from our pharmaceutical owner these patents that we had, and we're in the process of commercializing them now. We see ourselves as a part of the solution. We're not going to be the total solution, but we want to be a part of it. and our mission is at source destruction, minimizing the change of hands and minimizing the potential for abuse, emptying out medicine cabinets where we can help that out. And I'll turn it over to Jason for
a description of some of our products. Thanks. You know what? Can everyone hear me? I'm a fairly loud person by nature, so if you want the mic, it's going to be real loud. But anyway, you know what, Carter, why don't you hang on to that? I'll speak loudly. So the first product that Carter talked about that they came up with was called ContraPatch. And basically, if you think of this as kind of a large Band-Aid, if you were to take a transdermal patch, once it's done with its use, you would turn it over so the drug side was down. There's a certain type of activated carbon that's in here. You would put it on that pad. You would fold that over. It's strong adhesive on there, and you run it underwater. Through that process of carbon adsorption, it renders it deactivated over a period of time. We have some independent science that you can see at mesaway.com that proves this out through Mercy University. But it can take out 99% of that drug. It renders it unabusable. It also then can't leach out into the groundwater, so it can go straight into the into your garbage. We also have a product that we're talking to those pharmaceutical companies that you were speaking of a little earlier about prescribing this or dispensing this with every opioid prescription that they make. This is called Mezoway SP. It's for a single prescription. But the example that we kind of use is we talk about OxyContin or Percocet. You go to the doctor for pain, acute pain, they give you 10 pills, you use two. You have eight sitting in your medicine cabinet that can be stolen, taken, abused, or if you throw them in the garbage, it finds its way into our waterways. You would actually open this up, you drop in those unused pills, you'd add some water, you'd seal it back up, you give it a little time, and you throw this in the garbage. Again, that certain type of activated carbon bonds as those pills, that liquid adheres and bonds to that activated carbon. It renders it an unbreakable bond. It's now rendered deactivated and inert. We also have them for commercial application. We think of this is the Mezoway XL. It's for use in long-term care facilities. This can handle, you know, 450 pills. Thanks, Carter. 450 pills, liquids, so you could use multiple use. You just add a little bit of water every time you dump something in it. Once it was full, you'd seal it back up. That same deactivation process would take place, and this could then either be sent for incineration or thrown in the garbage as well. It's not for RCRA listed, not intended for RCRA listed drugs, but in the pharmaceutical industry, there just aren't that many, and certainly that many that are being sent today. This could also work well in a pharmaceutical setting. With all of the lobbying and the work that you're doing, if pharmacies, individual pharmacies, can take back these drugs, this could be a good solution for them. It's very cost effective. It's about $8, and so it does get these drugs out. It takes the burden off these take-back programs, which are great, but if we can reduce the amount of volume that goes into these take-back programs by deactivating and disposing of these drugs before they need to be, you know, accumulated, we think we can help this process along.
Great.
Any questions?
Any questions? Quickly.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to save it. You want to catch up with these guys?
Yeah.
We'd be more than happy to talk to you.
I know there's going to be a lot of questions here.
Sure.
If it's all right, what I'd like to do, we're a little behind.
Sure, no.
And this was a little impromptu. We wanted to give them an opportunity to talk about their programs. Hopefully we can make some of the comments during the next session. I want to thank our sponsors.
Thanks, guys.
We're going to move into another part of the program, which is those that are on the phone.
those that are on the phone right now. We're at the examining producer responsibility approaches from the local, state, and federal levels. And I'm going to give a very brief introduction to the topic, and then all of our speakers are now here, a little filibustering, if you will, to make sure that Supervisor Miley is able to get up. Welcome. Let's see, here's the slide. Okay, I'm not in anyone's way. Good. All right, so just most of you know the differences with EPR, the extended producer responsibility, product stewardship, the terms we use, just in terms of the terminology for those that don't know. We have both of these referred to manufacturers taking a financial and a management responsibility for the product at end of life. We use the term product stewardship to look at the whole life cycle from the design and manufacture all the way through to the end of life management. And for EPR, we use that to use end of life and regulated. Product stewardship could be voluntary or regulated, and EPR regulated. And that's just a hiding out here and ask for us all to figure out. EPR, now this is all laws we have here. And there's over 73 different laws without the model bill. It's a question whether or not we count those or how many we count as EPR. But for EPR, over 70 laws in 2013, you see what's happened over the past decade. A lot of these producer responsibility laws have been passed. These are the products: fluorescent lamps 3, paint 6, batteries 8, thermostat 10, water switches 14. Electronics 24 plus California's advanced recycling. And then up on the top right there, you see new mattresses, carpets, cell phones, agricultural pesticide containers, and one called framework law. So a lot of this legislation, 32 states have at least one EPR law that has been passed. There's 10 different product categories and only 70 laws. Now, pharmaceuticals, as I said earlier, it's unique. There's local, state, federal action, and local government here has taken a leadership role in Alameda County, which we'll hear about in just a minute. We have a lot of unique supporters. It's much different than other issues, particularly drug abuse prevention advocates, retail pharmacies, and others. So this is just a diagram, those on the phone, on slide 73, and very rudimentary kind of diagram about how the system might work, or hopefully it does work. This might look familiar in Alameda County, with manufacturer being responsible for financially and management responsibility, would pay into a stewardship organization, the black box there. They would contribute, usually based on market share, into that box, and then they run programs. And it's, we can get into what the collections are like, but you're hiring a PSD or waste management or company that is going to be running these programs, and the collection at the pharmacies, or it could be even the mail bag, or it could be at local governments, or it could be at the police station, right? So they are running them, they are paying for them. That cost can be passed to the retailer, retail pharmacy, to the consumer, and usually invisible. So this is, these kind of systems are done, the consumer, they might have their cost increase, they might not. What we do say is the purchase price of that medication, in this case, would include the cost of running this program. That's earlier we were saying what the impediment is for a retail pharmacy, that's it. So under these systems, they don't have to put out money. And we can talk about this a little bit more later, and I know it's a lot for those that haven't seen a diagram about this, but all EPR programs are similar to this. There's a couple like paint, carpet, mattresses, a little bit different in terms of the visibility. Activity around the states, we have 9 states here that have introduced bills. California, the latest, and each one usually builds on the other. We have more and more momentum, which we will hear about very shortly. And on the federal level, many of us have worked with Congressman Lee Slaughter from New York to introduce legislation a few years ago, and Mark and Shield taking a lead with us at PSI and others, to work with the Congressman Lee Slaughter to introduce the first EPR bill at a federal level in over a decade. A package was waiting in the past.
Hopefully we'll come back again, but we expect the reintroduction of this legislation in 2013 from the Congress. New York State has introduced two bills in January of this past year. They are directed to hospitals and residential health care facilities, not household pharmaceuticals. Obviously, big difference in terms of the regulation and how they operate, but still movement in this direction. And then Pennsylvania, they have required drug retailers. Actually, it's a bill that has not been passed. It's referred to the House Environmental Resources and Energy Committee, but it would require drug retailers to establish a system for collecting and disposing. So putting the burden on the retailer. So you can see these different laws. The other nine ones that I mentioned before, the EPR and the state, those are the EPR laws that would require the pharmaceutical manufacturers. This one, retailers. And with that, I would like to introduce Supervisor County. And as I said earlier, I was supervising to hear what I mentioned, but when the mayor spoke from Milwaukee, I said it takes all things. It can take one local government to really change things in a very drastic way. And I mentioned that the mayor in Hartford took a lead role on mattresses. And with that, it's really changed the whole dynamic for mattress stewardship in the United States. And I would say that Supervisor Miley is a trusted expert here in Comita, has really changed things, changed the dynamic for pharmaceutical stewardship here in the United States. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So good afternoon, everyone. It's real good to be here. Oh, actually, it's still morning. Just flew and got it here about 30, 40 minutes ago. So, let me just briefly say that for those who aren't familiar with Alameda County, it's one of the larger urban counties in California. We have about 1.5 million people and about a $2 billion budget, five county supervisors on one of five, and about 10,000 employees, and we're responsible for the county government and legislation, executive authority, quasi-judicial authority, and we have a county administrator who we hire to run the county for us. So getting this ordinance passed is a real big deal. I've got a limited time to talk, so I'm going to try to cover as much as I can. Kamiko's on my staff. She's my one of my policy people who worked on this. We've got material we're going to hand out. In this packet, you'll find our ordinance, our regulations, contact information, some a more thorough history on the ordinance and background on how we developed the ordinance, and then we'll be around to answer questions afterward as well when we get through lunch. So, next slide. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this. You know, when I got started in working on this a number of years ago, I didn't have a clue that this was even an issue, and it was the citizens who talked to me and said we needed to do something about the disposal, proper disposal of pharmaceuticals. And I said, well, why is that an issue? Why don't we just put them out on the trash can and let, you know, recycling pick them up? And duh. And they laughed at me. It's like, okay. And so, you know, some of my best policy has been generated at the grassroots from just listening to people and working with them. You know, I don't come up with these ideas. They do. So when I got educated around that, I said, oh, wow, this is a major issue. And then when we started hearing about how other jurisdictions and other parts, outside of the United States, had these product stewardship approaches in place already, I said, well, what's wrong with us? And the frustration was that we couldn't, you know, nothing was happening suitable and quickly enough at the state level or at the federal government level. So we had an senior alcohol and other drugs coalition made up of a lot of different partners, some of which are still part of the MEDS coalition, and an assessment was done. Public policy was looked at, and then also coalition building. But ultimately, with the public policy, said we needed to do a product stewardship approach. And this is a partial list of some of the supporters of the overall ordinance that was enacted. Next slide. So to get from where we started with the citizens up to the ordinance took years. Like I said, there was an assessment done. We had with seniors. We found out that this affected kids. They were abusing it. Youth were abusing it. We found out also that it was an issue in terms of the environment, putting it into the water streams. So it took a while to build momentum, but while we were doing all that, we did, you know, some take-back events and other things, but all along knowing we needed to move towards an ordinance that would have a producer responsibility. Next slide. So in order to build our coalition, you know, we did everything you can imagine to build a coalition because we needed everybody to be participating, all the stakeholders, because I often say to folks, this affects us all. I don't know of anyone who doesn't have some type of either over-the-counter or prescription medication in their house. So we reached out to not only stakeholders in our county, but outside of our county, San Francisco, San Mateo County, other counties, water districts, citizen groups, you know, anyone and everyone, I said, we need and want your support. And then ultimately, next slide. We were going to adopt the ordinance in February, March of 2012, but we held off on that. But backing up even before that, we held a conference in October of 2011, and it was at that conference that we said we would move ahead with the product stewardship ordinance. And at that time, we were even thinking about, well, we have one of two approaches. We can go to the Board of Supervisors, have the Board of Supervisors enact this, or we can do a ballot measure with the citizens of Alameda County and have the citizens enact it. And I, for one, wanted to do the ballot measure, but people kept saying to me, well, you know, farmers going to spend a lot of money, it's going to be very costly, it's going to be very time-consuming, so why not take the easy route? So eventually I was convinced to take the easy route, but even then, that wasn't easy. So we took it to the Board of Supervisors in February, and we had one reading. And then Pharma came out, and they said, well, we never even heard you were doing anything. How could you not hear we were doing anything? We've had hearings on this, meetings on this, it's been publicized, et cetera. So when they said they didn't hear anything about this, we said, okay, we'll give you a chance to get involved. So we held a series of stakeholder meetings that took place, about five or six of them that took place in the spring of 2012 before we went for a new reading. And the reason we had to go to a new reading is because we wanted to receive more input from Pharma. We wanted to see if we could have some consensus around an ordinance. But like, you know, naturally all they were there was just to stall and be naysayers. So ultimately, well, we did give them a chance to participate. The other supervisors recognized that. So we took it to a hearing in July of last year. First reading, the board adopted it. And then the second reading, it became the law. With our ordinance, next slide. Oh, and I just want to back up right there. That's the district attorney. Both the district attorney for Alameda County, the sheriff of Alameda County, the Board of Supervisors, everybody was on the same page in terms of the importance of adopting this ordinance, which really helped in terms of having that support. Because Pharma, quite frankly, told us they will bankrupt Alameda County. And they have sued us, but that's what they said to us in our county council. So having the support of all the major elected officials was really important. Next slide. So we got a lot of publicity, you know, New York Times, you know, a lot of publicity from a number of newspapers, radio stations, NPR, et cetera, et cetera, about what we did, the first of its type in the country. Next slide. What the ordinance requires is that either the manufacturers have to come up with a convenient and safe way of allowing consumers to return their unwanted or expired medications, or they have to go through a product stewardship organization and do that. And we leave that up to them. Our Environmental Health Department will then determine whether or not the plan they come up with is a suitable plan. The ordinance was adopted in July, and they would have until November, if my recollection is correct, to present their plan. When they sued us, we delayed implementation. And this was actually, this was July of 2012. They would have, I think, until June of the next year, which is 2013, to bring forth a plan. But when they sued us, we gave them until November of this year to bring forth a plan. That's kind of the time frame. Let's see. The next slide. We couldn't have done this without the help of the California Product Stewardship Council. You'll hear from Heidi. She's one of our consultants. Teleosis Institute's another one of our consultants, because they really helped us understand this issue and provided the technical expertise around both the nature of this concern as well as how to go about. Teleosis helped us draft the ordinance, worked with county council on that, and the Product Stewardship Council provided a lot of input for us on this. Next slide. Okay, so these are contact people to contact. Kamika is in my office. She kind of quarterbacks everything. You always get to her. The Meds Coalition, the Safe Meds Coalition, is a coalition of which the county, we are a part of, citizen groups, water districts, other bodies all participate in the Meds Coalition. It stands for Medication Education Disposal Safety Coalition. And you can get more information about the Meds Coalition. I've got that contact information too. Linda Pratt is the facilitator of our coalition from one of the organizations called Comfree. That information's in there. After we adopted the ordinance, and while we, you know, we're still, the ordinance is still being challenged legally, what County Council did, working with our Environmental Health Department, was write the regulations. So, you know, you have the law, now you have the regulations in terms of how that law is going to be implemented. And they spent maybe 6 months or so writing the regulations. So in the package, you'll see both the ordinance and the regulations. I think, like I said, I have a very, very little limited time, so I don't want to abuse my time, but I could talk a lot about this given the opportunity. But I thank you for listening, and I'll be around.
So we're going to do this a little bit differently than this morning. We're going to have a Q&A now, okay? Because I know there's going to be some questions. So we're going to do Q&A after each of the speakers. And Supervisor, you weren't here before, but we kind of got a funny little format. People have to come up here because there's a phone right near you, which loops us into a whole bunch of other people that are listening in. And they're not picking it up off the speakers. So we're hearing in the room with the mics, but it's not picking up. So if people would like a comment or a question, you can come up, we'll give you the mic, you can stand right over here after you do that. And on that side right here, it's a funny little format, but we're going to do this.
Say your name.
Walter Willis from Southwest Agency Lake County. Thanks for coming out. Can you explain a little bit more of the basis of their lawsuit?
Yeah, they're suing on the Commerce Clause under the Constitution, and they're saying we're violating interstate commerce. And I think that's a unique theory that hasn't been tried before with other product stewardship types of regulations and takebacks from batteries and oil, et cetera. And so if they win, I think it could have implications for other types of extended producer responsibility products that are being handled presently. We have a summary judgment hearing on the ordinance later this month, June 25th, in federal court in San Francisco. It's just formality. I don't think anything's going to be resolved. I actually think unless Farmer decides that it's in the goodwill, and they get a lot of goodwill out of doing this, it makes a lot of sense. It's pennies for them to have a safe, convenient way for consumers to take this back, pharmacies, whatever plan they want to come up with. Unless they come to that rationalization, I think this will end up in the it'll end up probably in the U.S. Supreme Court. That's what I think.
Now, I'm not an attorney, but my understanding of the Commerce Clause argument, though, is that they're saying that Alameda County is causing costs to be incurred by their company outside of the jurisdiction. Can you articulate that a little bit?
Yeah, they're saying we're harming these seniors. We're harming seniors in other states by imposing a cost on manufacturers with their products in Alameda County. I don't get it myself, but that's one of their arguments. We have outside counsel working with us on this. Obviously, we're interested in having other folks weigh in with amicus briefs as this thing proceeds ahead. Hopefully, the Product Stewardship Institute, except everybody, to help with this this litigation. But yeah, it's definitely a precedential setting.
Yeah, we agree that the same argument could be made on any EPR legislation on any product, even from local or state.
Leslie, you have a question or comment?
First of all, I want to thank you publicly because you are my hero.
I am. Wow.
You are a local government person who's doing the right thing. I work for local government in Minnesota, but I'm here to, as a Minnesota Product Stewardship Council president, to ask you if you could articulate how you became the leader that you are, because I work with commissioners who I wish were like you. I want to hear more about your story so that I can take that back.
Well, I think my story is unique. When I finished law school in 1976 in Maryland, at the University of Maryland, I went to California to be a Jesuit volunteer, worked with the Jesuits, and they're very socially minded. And my job was to do community organizing in Oakland, in the communities. This was in the 70s. And this, you know, Alinsky, this is before folks heard about community organizing with Obama. You know, this was back in the 70s. And so, so I was very socially conscious and socially minded, and working with people at the grassroots showed me how working with citizens and communities we could make City Hall responsive, and we could make it responsive. You didn't need a lawyer to do that for you. You know, people just needed to be organized and coached, and they could speak for themselves. And that's, yeah, if I had gone to practice law, I would have a different mindset. So I see things through the eyes of community organizing, and that helps me to understand how to get engaged and not be afraid of get engaged with citizens at the grassroots level. It's not always comfortable, but it's always worthwhile. And so I've led the charge on many issues, from alcohol and tobacco to other issues as well, both when I was on the city council in Oakland and as a county supervisor. So this is just, this is what I do. This is what I do. So I think for any elected official, to me it makes common sense to be in line with your constituents, to do the right thing, to do what they, you know, feel needs to be done. And unless it goes against your values or your morals or your ethics, then do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
My daughter just graduated from Wetland University, and they had Rajura Carter was one of the speakers, and she spoke about being comfortable in an uncomfortable place. And she mentioned her message to the graduates was, expect that you're going to get a lot of stuff heaped at you, and you're going to know who your supporters aren't and who your supporters are. Obviously, you're going to lose supporters here. But it's a tough place to be in. I'm so glad you're there. Other comments or questions, please come on up. And if you have some, let's try to do this quickly. I'm sure there's a lot of comments. If people could feel free to line up here if you have a comment or question, and save your name and affiliation. And by that phone over there so people on the phone can hear you as well. Here's the mic.
Hi, I'm Penny Black with the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, and I moved here from Los Angeles County, so appreciate if you still talk to me. my question is, and I guess I'm just having trouble wrapping my brain around this at a county level policy. Would it be, are they required to come up with a plan for drugs distributed or produced or collected? How does that?
Yes. Any manufacturer that who produces a pharmaceutical, and that pharmaceutical, that drug, is distributed in Alameda County, is responsible for coming up with a way to conveniently dispose of it. And so we sent out letters to over 4,000 potential producers to notify them of this. It took a while to gather that information as well. And we just finished a conference just a week or so ago where we had haulers in, producers, pharmacies, et cetera, to talk to them more about the ordinance and how the ordinance would be implemented. But yeah, if your product is distributed in Alameda County, you have a responsibility. That's the bottom line. And the state law, I think Heidi will probably talk more about that, is being patterned off of Alameda County.
Another comment. I'm just going to get those that are on the phone. We're going to go to you next just to see if you have any comments, those on the phone. So hang on there. I'll go to you next.
Hi, I'm Chris Miller, Audigan County, Recycling, Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, we have a product stewardship approach for electronics. With electronics, they're banned from the landfill, and then the manufacturers had to set up and help fund some collection programs. Basically, they have to help fund it. Do you have anything that restricts people from flushing or throwing them in the trash, or is it strictly all on the shoulders of the manufacturer to set up these programs, and the person at the end really doesn't have a responsibility?
Yeah, the pharmaceuticals, it's more or less, we don't have a law that mandates that the consumer has to do a certain thing with them, although with hazardous materials, oil, paint, other things, they do have to take that to our hazardous recycling facilities. They can't just dump that down the drain, et cetera, et cetera. But for pharmaceuticals, we don't have such a law in place relative, you know, for consumers. So that's why a lot of consumers, they either end up hoarding the stuff or they just dispose of it inappropriately. And so we're finding that that's a big public policy, environmental issue, health issue as well.
Are you thinking about maybe implementing something like that to make it illegal to flush, or
for the consumers?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
Oh, have you also thought about looking at the wastewater treatment plants?
Oh, yeah.
The people who are.
Yeah, they're involved. The water treatment facilities. They're definitely involved with this. And you know, all of us about it. Part of the effort at the grassroots is all about public awareness, raising awareness about this. Because a lot of consumers, they weren't aware that you couldn't flush it. And sometimes they might be aware, but they're lazy, because I don't want to take it to a location that's inconvenient or that might not be open when I need to get there, et cetera. So even if they were aware, they just wouldn't do it anyway. But a lot of times they just weren't aware. So part of our effort at the grassroots when this whole started was to try to raise awareness. Like I said, you know, I'm a pretty intelligent person. I try to do the right thing publicly, et cetera. And I didn't realize that you couldn't just put it in the trash can, or you couldn't just put it out to recycle. I said, why not? Yeah, and I often wonder why you couldn't just take it back to the pharmacies. But I never really thought more about it until people started talking to me about this. And this is after 20-some years as an elected official.
Any other comments or questions? I've never thought about a disposal ban. That really would be like getting, like having enforcement, like in your bedroom, like the bathroom.
Yeah.
Tough politically.
Yeah.
any other comment or question? Last one?
Okay, thank you.
On the phone, do we have folks that are interested in asking a comment or question? I know you're there.
Can I ask if there will be an opportunity to just address more generally the EPR, or is this just for Alameda County for now?
Well, right now it's for Alameda County, but what's your question?
Well, my name is Pierre Chevrier. I'm from the Environmental Impact Initiative at Health Canada. We're basically the Canadian counterpart to the FDA here. So we've been doing some research over the last little while, and a couple of things have tweaked our interest on EPR. In Canada, we have a group called the Canadian Councils of Ministers of the Environment. So that's a cross-jurisdictional group across provinces, like in the U.S. it'd be state governments with ministers of the environment. They're putting together something called the Canadian Action Plan on EPR. So in the next couple of years, they're looking at doing something across the board, Canada-wide, to tackle this issue. That's not to say that there necessarily will be regulated programs in every jurisdiction, but That's the goal, and it's nice, I guess, from our side to have that sort of one-stop shopping with one group that's going to tackle this. The other thing we have is an industry association called the Health Product Stewardship Association, and what they do is they coordinate the program in provinces where it's currently mandated. It's now mandated in three of our provinces. But they also provide promotion for other take-back programs across the country so that you can go on their site and just put in your address, and it'll tell you the closest place to drop off. And most of these are in pharmacy situations. So I guess my question is, is there such a group across jurisdictional, across states maybe, that might be able to take some leadership where you can drive this up and have it horizontal? And do you have an industry association that maybe tackles some of the EPR and the product stewardship issues across the country? I think one of the things that we have found is that where industry gets its hackles up is when there's a patchwork of very different approaches across the country. I think they find that more difficult. When things are more harmonized, they tend to be easier to get on board. So that's probably a few questions, but basically, is there a cross-jurisdictional state environment group where maybe you can drive this up, and is there an industry association doing any work across state lines? Sorry for the lengthy question.
Let me just quickly say that we brought Jeanette in from British Columbia. She talked to us about the model up there. We tried to pattern what we did off of British Columbia. The only reason we adopted an ordinance in Alameda County was because the state wasn't doing anything, the federal government wasn't doing anything. We'd love to have state regulation or national regulation that would deal with this issue. But short of that, we felt, at least my constituents felt, we couldn't wait any longer. And we'd rather have a patchwork and a lot of brush fires going on than to continue to have these products being abused, going down the, you know, going into the water stream, going into the landfills, kids getting into them, teenagers getting abusing them, et cetera. So that's why we went ahead with this. And our hope is that, as a result of it, we'll get the type of thing you're talking about, both in the state of California and hopefully nationally.
Yeah, thank you, Supervisor, and thank you for your question. Yeah, a number of us are familiar with Jeanette Vanez, who does run the sort of the industry stewardship organization in Canada. And most of us that are working in this field look to Canada as a leadership leaders in this area. They have several provinces that are operating under the system. I can say very briefly, in 2008, that is why the Product Stewardship Institute had a national stakeholder dialogue meeting, was to develop regionally consistent, nationally consistent regulations and programs, and we gave the industry an opportunity to sit down and develop solutions together. And as I said, a couple of them came, and as you'll hear, they're still not, as you've heard from the supervisor, they're still not willing to come and discuss the issue. And until that is the case, you're not going to have that nationally coordinated system. I think what we're trying to do here is to develop nationally coordinated regulation. If California passes a law, becomes the first year, it's going to take off of what Alameda County has developed. And each of the states is going to look for each other, and there will be industry stewardship organizations that step up. It will develop. But we're at the very nascent stages. We're seeing it in paint, right? You have the American Coatings Association established paint care. It's one stewardship organization. You have Carl here from Cold to Recycle, right? Cold to Recycle is a national stewardship organization that coordinates all the rechargeable batteries in the country. So you're going to see this set up here in the United States. I'll get off my high horse here, and thank you, Supervisor. Now we have Heidi Sanborn from the California Product Stewardship Council, and Heidi's going to talk about statewide legislation on pharmaceuticals. Heidi?
Thank you, Scott. And just to address that question, I think in order to get harmonization, we're going to have industry leadership, which we do not have right now. The reason paint is going to be harmonized is because the industry decided to step forward, and they thought it would be better than having a patchwork approach, and unfortunately, pharma isn't there yet, so we'll see. And I wanted to thank Supervisor Miley. I have always said he's my hero. We actually gave him a leadership award last year, and we're just glad that we could share him with you today and all that they have done, but really, they deserve an enormous amount of credit for taking this on. So thanks again. So I'm going to talk very briefly about the California Product Stewardship Council and what we've been doing to work on producer responsibility and now on pharmaceuticals. We'd actually thought, my board said, please don't focus on pharmaceuticals. That is the biggest lobby.
they have the most money, and if they're not ready, we don't want to pick on them. And I was actually warned by a committee consultant when we started our council back in 2006. He was saying, "Many best attorneys, so don't dare pick on pharma until like you're big enough, because they don't go for blood, they go for kill." That was a quote, and I never forgot it. So when Alameda and San Francisco started picking on pharma, I said, "Oh boy, here we go, here we go." But the thing is it was time, and it's an issue whose time has come. I think the public is ready, and we have to take this actually to the public, because the public wants this, but if they don't know, they can't help, and I think at this point we're going to have to activate them, because we do have strong opposition that we're up against at this point. So our council started in 2006, because our state had this really bad thing where they would just put disposal bins, and we talk about pharmaceutical disposal bins. They're unenforceable. Nobody's in your bedroom or your garbage can figuring out what you got. And so when the state would impose these bans without plans, we call them, they didn't work. And they just frustrated the public, and they frustrated local governments. And we call them unfunded local government mandates. So we formed our council to actually start looking at a producer responsibility approach for multiple products that were hazardous or we thought should not be disposed of and would get a sustainable funding source. Our council now has a 14-member board, five of which are private sector and includes Ultimed, which is one of five Sharps producers. And several waste haulers, including Red Sanitary Service and Republic Services, which is our largest funder and second largest hauler in the country. So what's been going on in California on pharmaceuticals since 2007, this has been a major issue. In fact, Senator Simidian at the time is now a county supervisor back in Santa Clara County, which is the city of San Jose. And he passed SB 966, which developed required us to do a couple things, including develop model program guidelines for take-back, so it was clear what could or could not be done. And then a 2010 report to the legislature that was put together by CalRecycle, again on the PowerPoint you have these links, which encouraged that we take an APR approach, which would require legislation. So actually the legislation that we've introduced this year follows the recommendations that CalRecycle provided back to the legislature in 2010. We also last year worked on a bill with Assemblymember Wykowski, which amended the Medical Waste Management Act to allow the common carriers transport and reverse distribution at pharmacies. We previously had a law that was a real impediment that actually would force the pharmacies to not use their existing reverse distributor, but another outside carrier, and that just seemed ridiculous and silly when they were all bringing back medications from the pharmacy anyway. So we got that passed and got that barrier out of the way. And then now we've introduced SB 727 with Senator Hannah Beth Jackson, and that is a true EPR bill for pharmaceuticals in California. So I'll talk about all of these three things. Again, the report to the legislature basically said we need two options related to pharmaceutical waste collection programs. The first being these statutory changes to establish clear state roles and responsibilities and provide direction to resolve several implementation challenges. The Board of Pharmacy worked with CalRecycle on the report, and that was the first time those two agencies had ever worked together, you know, waste and the Board of Pharmacy. So that was an excellent guideline, which does require a two-key system. I don't know if that bin has a two-key, but that what that means is that the drug collector, when the truck comes, he's got one key, and the pharmacist has the other, and both have to be present to open it so that there is no drug diversion. There's two eyes at all times. Of course, now they're talking about a different type of bin that destroys it as it goes into the bin. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then the second was the statutory direction and the law to address the funding barriers, providing funding through a private sector approach with government oversight, which is a producer responsibility approach. Again, the Wykowski legislation, I can't count here, I'm a little tired, one, two, and one, but... it amended the Medical Waste Management Act, which is our state's act overseeing, and I think this gentleman here was talking about the issues that poor retailers and all of us have to deal with. They're just so complex and so confusing, and how on earth can a risk lawyer for a retailer feel confident that they can follow the rules because they're so confusing. So that's one issue. It again defined pharmaceutical waste, which had not been defined before in state law in California, and then exempted it from the definition of pharmaceutical waste, any pharmaceutical that is being sent to a properly licensed reverse distributor. So again, I put the bill text and the link there in case you're interested, in case that was something your states are dealing with. But that was a big barrier for us to get out of the way. After Alameda, took the brave step and adopted first in the country EPR ordinance for pharmaceuticals, we decided that it was time to actually introduce state legislation. So the California Product Stewardship Council actually was talking to different legislators about SHARP's legislation. That was our bigger issue because they're sticking our solid waste workers. And several legislators said, well, SHARP's and pharma are very similar stakeholders. Why don't we just take them both on? Okay, that's a really big lift. But then it ended up that two legislators wanted to do two different bills. One did SHARP's and one did pharma. So we ended up with pharma, and then we said, well, gee, this is like a really hard bill, so we need lots of co-sponsors. So we're excited that we got Clean Water Action to be a co-sponsor, along with the County of Alameda, City County San Francisco, and the California Association of Retired Americans had apparently been already working on legislation, and we didn't even know that that was going on. They were shopping their own legislation while we were talking to other legislators, and the legislators put us together and said, that's great, you guys can all work together. And so their big issue is just to make sure the price of the medications don't scream up, and that's something that you'll hear because in Mexico and Canada, from what I understand, they have socialized medicine in a way that caps the profit margins. And in the U.S., we don't, and in the new healthcare laws, we still don't. That was part of the agreement, and so a lot of the profits being put in the American medical pharmaceutical costs, and they don't want to see that addressed here. So anyway, this bill is actually a mirror of the Alameda Ordinance. It does make the manufacturers responsible to design and operate the system and do all the public education around it to make sure it works, to provide statewide coverage. We have a two-year session, and we were at the beginning of the two-year session this year. The bill went to the first committee, the Senate Environmental Quality Committee, and the chair of that committee had received enormous amounts of input from everyone. And we have a very, very long list of support. It includes L.A. Water District, which is the biggest in the country, and, you know, retirement groups, drug prevention groups. It's actually the largest list of support, broadest groups we've ever had for any of our bills. And that bill is became a two-year bill at the committee. The chair decided that this was a great start, but we needed to have public hearings. And I think the thing that is most exciting, and I hope you will all follow, and I'm happy if you give me your card to get you on our listserv about this bill, it's going to have public stakeholder meetings in our legislature in July and August. And this is the first time a legislature has asked everyone to come to the table in a public arena and put the cards on the table. And unfortunately, at the local level and every other time we've tried to have these open discussions, it has not worked. The lobbies are very, very well funded, and they simply just go around the back door, close the door, have a conversation, and the whole thing's over. And we never got to see what the issues were. So we're really excited about that and hope you'll follow them and weigh in on the legislation as well. And if you'd like to contact Linda Barr, Senator Jackson's office, that's her email address and phone number. And she would love to hear from you if your groups would like to support this group effort, or if you have suggestions for the legislation, it will lead the country. And so, especially if we can get it passed. But I think the discussion is at least in the forefront for the country. So it'd be great to have you all weigh in because we'd love a really, really good bill and set a good model for the rest of the country. And if you'd like to watch the YouTube, we've got on YouTube several local officials from Alameda County and others talking about the need for drug take-back, seniors, college students, et cetera. You can use all those videos. They're all public, and they're all on our YouTube page. And then we got a grant from the Rose Foundation, which is protecting Bay Area water quality, and we actually decided to kind of make it a more fun thing. Don't rush to flush is our motto. And mess in the bin, we all win. So this is our new Facebook page. It's literally brand new. As you can see, I just took it from 11 likes. But if you could like us and do Twitter and Facebook, that would be great because we're going to put a lot of information out on those new medication collection bins that we're putting. But this is my urging to grantees and grantors on this issue. If we continue to fix the problem at the back end, what is the inspiration to take this and say there's a problem in the state capitol? And that's the argument that we got at the Sharps hearing for the Sharps bill. They actually said, Norman Ridge said at the hearing, there's been this great new list of hundreds of collection sites around the state in the last 3 years that local government are paying for. What's the problem? So you're basically handing them ammunition to shoot at you if you fix it too much.
So my urging is that if you're going to give grants and give priorities to those jurisdictions that are looking to not just completely fix the problem, but to transition this, because we need more people to quarterback in this team of, you know, the pharmacies need to understand. In this grant, I have six bins, and we're not paying for disposal at one of them. Every single pharmacy that signed up got the bin for free. We're promoting them, but they had to agree to pay for disposal for 5 years after we walked away. And guess what makes them really excited then to help support the legislation? They're paying the cost now, and they'd like somebody else to be paying for that cost of disposal. But they're willing to host the collection. So that's what we call EPR transitional. It's transitioning some of the cost to a different stakeholder who's profiting from that product in the system. So it is, you know, something to think about when you're doing grants, but working with these other people so that they will help your big supporters for good legislation in the future. And we have a lot of education. We have a pharmaceutical webpage on our website, and you can follow us on Facebook, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And thank you very much for having me.
On the pharmaceutical, in the pharmacies, how do you deal with controlled substances and hazardous pharmaceuticals? What do they do for that program?
We are saying for now that they cannot take controlled substances. So we ask people to put them in a baggie and bring them in. But controls have to go to a sheriff's location. We have one, it looks like sheriff's location, that will take all of them. But we know that people aren't going to make separate trips. Hazardous. How do people know it's hazardous? I mean, that's the issue. Nobody knows. Half the time, they don't even know if they're controlled. You know, and then now I've got the Board of Pharmacy saying on the bill that they would like us to make sure that we write in requirements that the bin destructs the pills as they're entering the slot. Well, if you've got radioactive drugs, they're creating dust. This couldn't be a good thing for the pharmacy. And then we did find a bin that does that, but if it needs a HEPA filter and it needs to be cleaned, and you know, there's a whole layer of cost and problems with that. So we have to all work together, because that's way beyond what the DEA was proposing in their regulations. But it may be what our Board of Pharmacy requires. I don't know. So hopefully we can all have this national discussion and get on the same page. But we have to have a program that's cost-effective and works. But we can't overcomplicate this to the public, because we can't even get them to sort alkaline from rechargeable batteries. Right, Carl?
Walter Willis with Lake County, Illinois. More specifics about the bill, assuming it's cost internalization.
Correct.
As far as convenience standards, are there any standards for convenience of access to collection sites?
Well, again, the bill is going to go through a whole lot of gyrations this summer after the stakeholder meetings, and I think that is a major, major question. We did put a convenience standard in. I can't even remember now what it was, like one for every 10,000 people, something to that effect, and that could be way off. We don't know. But we do need, you know, we're kind of tired of negotiating with ourselves. So we really need other partners at the table to tell us what they can live with and what they think is reasonable, because right now what we get is just nothing.
And are there any goals that are put in the law as far as trying to recover X percent?
No, because it really gets to that, first of all, you don't want to discourage people from taking their meds. You have really no idea how many are out there. And so to hold an industry accountable for you can argue that data all day long. And pharma has really good scientists, and they're really good at data arguments. I wouldn't want to have that one with them. I think the main thing is to make sure there's two things that we found in these collection programs to make sure it's going to work. One, that you educate the public with a clear, concise message. You focus groups to make sure that messaging works. Number two, you make it convenient. If you have those two things, you're going to get the 80%, 80-20 rule. You've always got 20% curmudgeons and people who won't lift a finger or make one extra bit of effort. But most people really want to do the right thing, especially with these kinds of
things.
Yeah.
Battery man,
yeah. Oh, no!
Carl Smith, Call the Recycle. HUD and I have been through a number of EPR wars, particularly in California, that I've had the joy in not only four states, but many provinces in Canada dealing with it. I get the sense now, at least in the U.S., that if anything, the appetite for EPR legislation has waned and is not on the upswing. We found that in California on batteries when there's a supermajority in both houses and a quite aggressive governor, we couldn't get anything moving. So I know I'm not trying to put cold water on this because, you know, we've tried on a number of levels to get something through. I'd like your assessment on prospects, but particularly what's the alternative if we can't keep the states act?
Well, I can tell you for batteries, we've already got several jurisdictions that have ordinances written that will be introducing them. If we can't, after 3 years of working to get, you know, first of all, with 2 years working against the industry, then we had industry support this year for alkaline batteries, and then we got so much opposition, including pharma. Now, why do you think that was? Getting too close. So now they're starting to oppose everything. And this is where we have to all get really smart, and I hope you all stay for tomorrow's discussion if you're if you have the invitation to have this quiet discussion about how are we going to strategize, because we need to think big, long picture, long term about if you push too hard, too fast with too many different products, you create too much kickback. They organize and they get all upset. And I really feel like, you know, this got lost in the shuffle that we really want to work with industry. We don't want to fight. We're just trying to get a good program going, but we can't have it all externalized onto the public sector. We don't have the resources. So I think that this is a very challenging time, and you can't outrun them. They've got more money, and they've got more political power, quite frankly. As my friend at the League of Cities said early on to me, she said, local governments don't give money to campaigns, companies do. And that's the truth. So we have to be realistic, and we have to be, you know, honest about what we can do with what we've got. And it's leadership, like Supervisor Miley has taken, that is going to help move this ball along. And if all of you wait for this to settle, it's not going to help. We need everybody working together and introduce as much and get as much attention and much public discussion on this as we can. And I would suggest that this is the issue because there is so much support from so many different groups that you can engage a lot of the public.
I would agree with that and also just add that I actually see change over the past year of an uptick of momentum on product stewardship. We've had a couple of bills passed already, a couple of laws passed here in the United States, and you know, over 70 bills have been introduced, and we have changes in two major industries, the single-use battery industry and also mattresses. And so I see that the momentum is actually building. It just takes an awful lot of effort and coordination. So that's what I'm seeing. I do see the intense pushback, but I see some of that starting to wane. But thank you very much, Heidi. I'll give her a big hand. Our next speaker, and I recognize we're going over for lunch here. We're going to wrap up here, certainly by one, maybe a little bit before. Those that are on the phone, we're going to pick up some of the slack. We're going to run on lunch from about 1 to 1:45. We're going to cut a little bit there. We're going to cut a little bit in another place in the afternoon to catch up here. I just thought it was really important to have this discussion to continue it moving forward with a lot to say. And our third speaker in this power panel here is Margaret Shields. And I was thinking how do I introduce you, but you know, we both have the same boss. This guy over here, Dave Galvin, the president of the Public Stewardship Institute, and also your boss here. And you've done a tremendous job yourself here in the country. Fiona Margaret, she's a go-to person for almost anything on this issue. And the Northwest, so Margaret's from King County, Seattle, Washington State, Oregon, the Northwest has really advanced the ball on this issue, I believe, earlier than anyone has. They developed what they call a farm program with the pharmacies and just pushing the envelope and got this whole thing moving in the country. And I just want to recognize that even though you don't have a law yet, maybe in the future here, but you can talk about the ordinance that has been introduced in King County, which is a significant advancement for King County, but you have certainly both you and others in the area have advanced the ball on this issue for many, many years. So thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Well, and I have to say that person who got the ball rolling was Dave Galvin, who probably 9+ years ago, probably you were thinking about it even before then, really got pharmaceutical take back and stewardship on our agenda, and it's been there ever since as a high priority. So thanks for inviting me here today to tell you what's going on in Washington State and in King County, and thanks for hanging in there until lunch. So we're being tenacious. We're still working until the problem is solved. This is a map of take-back locations in Washington State. It's probably a little bit dated, but it shows red triangles where there are pharmacy take-backs and green crosses where there are law enforcement take-backs, and all these sites are listed on our takebackyourmeds.org website, which our program coordinates. And this map, to me, really shows why we need a statewide program. We don't have opportunities for safe, secure, and environmentally sound disposal of medicines all across the state. And even in the areas that have take-backs, those are some of our highest population areas, and there just aren't enough of them. We have worked, as many of you know, on statewide legislation for many years. We built a broad statewide coalition about as diverse as they get. We've worked very hard on at the state level from 2009 through 2012. It was a serious legislative effort. I can tell you that there's not a single state legislator in Washington State that hasn't been pressured on this issue and doesn't have a position. And we've come achingly close in our state Senate to passing the bill, one vote away. But the powerful pharmaceutical lobby has blocked us thus far. And that's very frustrating. No one believes that we're done yet at the state level, but our state Senate became more conservative this year, and with our legislative allies, we decided not to run the state level bill again. But now at King County, we're looking at a potential solution. And King County is kind of in the middle of the map there on Puget Sound. We have right now about 24 pharmacy take-back locations, and out of almost 350 pharmacies in our county. We have 11 law enforcement take-back sites out of 50 law enforcement stations, but none of those law enforcement take-back sites are in any of our big cities like Seattle or Bellevue or Renton or Kent. We know there's high public demand, and I would actually just add, I know there's complexities to this issue. Believe me, working on it this many years, there's regulatory complexities, there's this, that, and the other, but you know what? When it comes right down to it, it's pretty darn simple. It works. Take-backs at pharmacies and law enforcement work. We just haven't got enough of them, and we haven't got the sustainable financing, and they're not promoted. It is simple. We just need to get that done. So in King County, we are working through our King County Board of Health. Now, in our state, under state law, every county has a Board of Health, and they are authorized and empowered to protect public health and public safety. They are a legislative body that independently sets rules and regulations to govern public safety. We have 8 elected county and city officials on the board and 3 non-elected health professionals. The faces you see there are 2 of our leaders. Board member Mayor David Baker is the mayor of Kenmore, and he has championed this issue at the local, state, and federal level for many years, and when our state bill died in 2012, he went to our board chair, Joe McDermott, and said the board needs to take this up and work on a solution at the local level. And then Sharon McDermott has taken it on, and he is a passionate protector of public health. He has been a leader in our state on tobacco control initiatives, so he knows what it's like to go up against tough opponents. And I really want to thank them for their commitment to this issue, thank everyone that's worked on it, thank our public health director, David Fleming, who has really engaged in this issue and become a leader on it. And this kind of overviews the process that our Medicine Return Subcommittee has undergone. They formed a subcommittee, which is what they always do to work on legislation, started meeting in July of 2013. It's been a really open process. And, 2012. Gosh, I got the dates wrong. You can kind of see I got it mixed around there. First meeting July of 2012, and they've worked through 2013. The process has been really, really open. We learned from Alameda where the industry said, oh, gee, we didn't know that was going on. And so there's been public meetings where all stakeholders have been invited to participate. Pharma has been invited to speak, and many of the pharmaceutical lobbyists have done so. After examining the issue, the board decided that local policy action was needed and recommended a product stewardship approach as a sustainable solution. Legislation has been drafted. We had an initial public hearing on May 16th. There was really broad and diverse support from the community. The only folks in opposition are the pharmaceutical industry. There's another hearing and potential action scheduled for June 20th, just next week, and potential action means a vote. The website listed at the bottom of the slide, I know that's hard to read, but that has all the meeting materials and information from our subcommittee's process, and I've been the lead policy staff on it, and I can tell you the subcommittee has kept me and other staff in our program running with all the research questions they've had and policy option questions, and it's all posted online. So please make good use of our work and mine it for your own activities. I'm going to go through quickly a couple slides just to sort of frame how our board has worked on it. We always wanted to be really clear about our problem statement, what's the problem we're trying to solve, and because the board is focused on public health and safety, that's been our frame. They are looking to reduce the epidemics of abuse and poisonings from medicines in the home. Their mission is not protecting aquatic species. I know many of you are really coming from, okay, someone is going to come running to try and fix that, I am sure. So the public safety frame may sound a little limiting to you, but that really is a tremendously compelling argument to do this work, and that the board has focused on that. And I can tell you that all the stakeholders that are coming at this from the water quality angle are still with us because they understand the benefits that will come from it. We've also been really clear in explaining that addressing this complex public health crisis requires a multifaceted strategy. There are some stakeholders, notably the industry, that are saying, well, medicine take-back isn't going to solve the problem of abuse and poisoning. Well, perhaps not by itself, but it's part of this comprehensive strategy with all of these activities. That is how you have effective prevention. And our Board of Health knows about effective prevention. They understand that it takes multiple approaches. And in our state, we have actions going on with all of the three other areas. Medicine take-back is the missing link. Our board also understands that education alone won't solve this problem. You have to really change the environment, change the amount of access to drugs. We've been really clear about defining the barriers that exist to having a take-back program in our county and looking for a solution that will address all of those. And we've looked at the models in other jurisdictions. We've looked at the pharmaceutical model in Canada. We have been watching what's going on in Alameda County extremely closely. The Board of Health has a lawyer that's been working with us throughout the process of drafting this regulation. We've been looking at the arguments in the court case, and we feel comfortable moving forward with our legislation. So an overview of the rule and regulation. Let me get this all loaded up here. I have some two-page handouts that summarize the rule and regulation. Again, it's all online. But just to give you a little bit of overview of it. So a lot of people ask me, why is it called a rule and regulation? Well, that's what legislation is called for our Board of Health. Often it is more detailed than you might see in a state-level bill. We have the ability to pass a rule or a guidance afterwards to clarify some details. But the rule and regulation is quite detailed itself. It goes into more detail and specifications than Alameda's ordinance does because of the way we do legislation. The rule and regulation requires the pharmaceutical companies, any drug producer selling a covered drug in or into King County will have to provide the system. We're requiring that there should be secure drop boxes in retail pharmacies and in law enforcement offices. We have quite a strong service convenience goal, which actually says that any pharmacy or law enforcement office that volunteers to participate must be included in the drop-off system. Because those collectors serve voluntarily, if there aren't enough collectors that volunteer and there's essentially a service gap in part of the county, then the drug producers will have to organize collection events and or prepaid mailers to serve those residents. The ordinance, the rule regulation goes into detail about how collected medicines have to be securely handled. It specifically says that they have to be handled in accordance with all federal and state laws, including DEA regulations and including the policies of our Washington State Board of Pharmacy. Collected medicines will have to be disposed of at either a properly permitted hazardous waste facility, or if logistical or cost barriers can be demonstrated to using a hazardous waste facility, then they must be disposed of at a waste-to-energy facility. And that matches the EPA's disposal guidance on medicines from residential take-back programs. And then drug producers have to finance it. As I said, there's some shared cost facilities, shared cost responsibilities I'll mention in a moment. So our role in regulation requires that all drug producers have to create a stewardship plan. So like other EPR legislation, they have some flexibility to design the system to meet the rule and regulations requirements. All the producers have to work together in a standard plan, but there is an option where a single producer or a group of producers can opt out and propose an independent plan, would have to meet all the same requirements. It's basically just a way that they could have some control over their business relationships and who they work with. Drug producers are responsible for all these costs listed here: collection supplies, transportation, disposal, promotion, administration, agency fees. There is language in the ordinance about how voluntary collectors at pharmacies or law enforcement.
Let's wrap up the speaking here, then we'll turn it on.
Okay. So there is language about how voluntary collectors would provide in-kind staff time at those drop-off sites. So that is a shared responsibility. Another significant shared responsibility is my program, the Local Hazardous Waste Management Program, which that's our little acronym, LWOMP, will assist with startup costs of purchasing secure drop boxes, which is really a substantial contribution from our ratepayer-funded program. And then we'll also assist with education and promotion. The drug producers are required to do education and promotion, but we'll do some to complement that. Language in our rule and regulation also says, and it's actually language identical to Alameda County's, that there can't be a specific charge at point of sale or point of collection for the medicine take-back. However, it's clear that our Board of Health doesn't intend to exclude the producers from recovering their costs and other means. Our staff report for the May 16th hearing describes some cost estimates that we've done. We know that from lists of drug distributors we've looked at, there's at least 167 companies that sell pharmaceuticals in our state. And medicine sales in our county alone are more than $1.1 billion per year. The ballpark estimate we have on the cost of the take-back program is about $1 million per year. And that estimate is really going to depend on program design. It's going to depend on the amount of medicines collected. When staff did this estimate, when I did this estimate, I was assuming a lot of costs that the drug manufacturers may not have to include. So I actually view it as a kind of a high-end estimate. And even with that, $1 million per year is less than 0.1% of annual medicine sales, or it's a couple pennies per prescription bottle that's sold. So we do have online resources. If you Google for King County Board of Health, you'll find their page. Look on kind of lower right for a link to our Subcommittee on Secure Medicine Return. Lots of materials there. The hearing will be held June 20th at 1:30. There will be streaming video and a phone number that you can call in to listen in. So wish the board well. And I hope to have more coming soon from our county on that. We also have a lot of resources on our takebackyourmeds.org website as well. Thanks for your time.
Those that are on the phone line, we're going to, as you can tell, we're over here. That's why the phone line was just for, I guess, the one. It's going to cut off in a minute, so you know we're just going to do a quick Q&A here, so you're not going to miss a huge amount, but you have all the materials. We're going to come back 1:45.